Good Tuesday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host. Glad that you're with us this afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us today. We have a fantastic program for you. Nick Adams, the author of the brand new book, out today, I believe, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness, will join us on the program here in about 20 minutes or so. Also on the program this afternoon, Mr. Rick Echter of Rick's Firearm Academy of Detroit. The number of concealed carry holders across Michigan has soared over the last few years. A newspaper story says that the number of crimes committed by concealed carry holders have soared as well. I'll talk with Rick about this. I got to tell you, in terms of the number of crimes being committed in Michigan by concealed carry holders, the number is still infinitesimally small compared to the number of overall crimes that are being committed. But we'll talk about it with Rick Echter later on in the hour. Next hour, Barca Herman from Her Rights will join us. We talked a little bit about Barca on yesterday's program with Bob Owens from Bearing Arms. Jen Jakes at Bearing Arms had written a piece about Barca and her group, Her Rights. Down in Florida, they offered free firearms training for 20 women. 900 women applied for the training. When we talk about the growing number of Americans who are becoming gun owners, who are for the first time in their life deciding, yeah, I actually do want to exercise that right that I possess. I haven't exercised it up until now, but now I do want to exercise that right to keep and bear arms. This isn't hyperbole. This isn't hype. It's not some attempt to craft a narrative. It's actually taking place. And Barca is seeing it herself. So we'll talk with Barca Herman next hour. Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation says the Obama administration wants to make sure that non-citizens vote in the upcoming election. We'll talk with Hans about what's being done by the administration in that regard. In hour three, we have the Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorps Defense. Our Deal of the Day, our Good Guy of the Day, plus Chris Chang with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties, the group that has formed in opposition to Lieutenant Gavin Newsom's anti-gun referendum that he wants to put on the ballot in November. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum will join us in Hour 3 as well. Plus, we have all of the day's Second Amendment news and information from all around the country. We told you yesterday, if you missed yesterday's program, permitless carry passing out of the state Senate there in West Virginia. It is going to Governor Earl Ray Tomlin's desk. If you're a West Virginia gun owner, make sure that the governor's office has heard from you. And the governor says he's going to veto the bill. But lawmakers have the veto-proof majority, and it looks like they will have the time to override the governor's veto if that's the case. But who knows? Maybe if Governor Tomlin hears from a lot of West Virginia residents, he'll accept the will of the voters there. In Texas, you know, at the first of the year, the law changed, and open carry became legal in the state of Texas. In the weeks before the law changed, we saw a lot of the usual types of columns and commentary that Texas was going to hell, and we would soon be able to see the very visible results of that because this law made Texas a more dangerous place. The Austin American Statesman, which is not the most conservative paper in Texas, has the story, Open Carry Controversy Started with a Bang, but Shooting Blanks So Far. Huh. Of course, who was responsible for helping to create this controversy, if in fact it was ever a controversy? The media there in Texas, right? I mean, they would be the ones who would be hyping this thing up. I suppose we should be thankful that they are acknowledging, to whatever extent, the fact that this was a bunch of hype. Philip Jankowski of the Austin American Statesman says, 50 days into the open carry era in Texas, things in the Austin metro area have been conspicuously calm. So the policy's critics thought the law allowing gun license holders to openly carry handguns would usher in a modern-day Wild West, but the American Statesman found only two 911 calls have been made to the Austin area police since the law took effect on January the 1st. Neither case resulted in criminal charges or any violence. The placid denouement after all the fervor surrounding the law's adoption had its supporters reminiscing about the period 2 decades ago when similar outcry accompanied the passage of concealed carry laws in Texas. Yeah, because some things never change. Susanna Hupp, former Texas House member, who the American Statesman says was at the forefront of the movement to pass concealed carry laws in 1995, a survivor of the Luby's massacre, said, it's kind of funny, and it was hard for me not to chuckle when I heard the same stupid arguments I heard years and years ago. As with open carry, Hupp said police chiefs across Texas testified at the Capitol that concealed handguns would be harmful to police. Backed by an association representing chiefs across Texas, Austin's chief, Art Acevedo, fought strongly to defeat the open carry bill as it made its way through the legislature last year. And now that it's gone into effect, much ado about nothing. Austin police, the statesman writes, focus on educating their department about the law, according to police commander Andy Michael, who trains officers. Call takers at the 911 center receive training on what to ask callers who report a person openly carrying a firearm, such as finding out whether it was holstered. They were asked to explain the law to the callers and dispatch an officer if the caller requested it. Commander Andy Michael says it turns out that bit wasn't even all that necessary because the calls aren't coming in. So it's not as if, well, the public is freaked out about this, but the 911 dispatchers, they're diffusing the situation, so we're not seeing, you know, officers running around all over Austin tracking down these people who are openly carrying firearms. No, the calls themselves are not coming in. One 911 call did come in on January 10th when a man told police he felt threatened by a man openly carrying a firearm inside the La Tapatia restaurant at Anderson Mill in U.S. 183 in Northwest Austin. The two-man exchanged heated words in which the weapon carrier asked the other man to take things outside. Officers came to the restaurant, took a statement from the armed man who never brandished or even touched the gun and left, according to police. One other 911 call involving open carry occurred January 3rd in Round Rock, Texas, came from a staff member at the HEB grocery store, which has banned open carry at all of its locations. In that instance, a man walked into the store with a firearm. The store security staff called the police, as is the retailer's standard practice, according to the 911 call. Presumably, the guy left. Statesman doesn't say that any arrests were made or that police even made contact. Commander Andy Michael says he has yet to see a person openly carrying a firearm. So, again, I suppose credit where credit is due. The Austin American Statesman didn't have to write this story, but they did, and good for them. But again, a lot of the controversy over this legislation stemmed from the media, stemmed from the press, who is, look, controversy is like a steak dinner to the media, right? That's what they live for. They live for controversy. That's great. It sells newspapers. It drives eyeballs to your website. It involves clicks. So if you can, you know, if you can't cover a controversy, you can create one, which is the next best thing. And if you can create a controversy, at some point, you know, again, if you want to maintain credibility with your audience, you do sort of have to acknowledge at some point, right, that, we thought this could be controversial, but turns out not to be. Thought it could be awful, kind of thought it could be the Wild West, but turns out not to be anything at all. Now, that won't stop them from deciding that something else is going to be a controversy until it is not. But, you know, credit where credit is due, but also blame where blame is due as well. And the fact of the matter is, there is nothing controversial. There really is nothing controversial about laws expanding the right to carry across this country. We have seen this really since the founding of this country, but in the modern era, going back to, 1987 with Florida, right? And since then, we have seen right to carry expand into, theoretically anyway, every state in the union, although there are still a few states out there that are not shall issue. They are a discretionary issue. They can deny you your license to carry for any reason or no reason whatsoever. We have seen the number of Americans who are concealed carry holders grow to at least 13 million, if not more. Again, we have seen in state after state across this country record numbers of concealed carry holders. And what has happened to our violent crime rate in this country while all of this has been occurring over the past few decades? Why, it's been dropping to the lowest levels in 40 years, to among the lowest levels in U.S. history. The violent crime rate has been dropping. Now, again, I'm not saying that is because of concealed carry holders, but I am saying it's taken place while we've had more concealed carry holders. So it seems to me like concealed carry doesn't lead to more crime. Seems to me like concealed carry and less crime absolutely can go hand in hand, because that's what we've seen around the country. And everything else, whether we're talking about open carry, whether we're talking about campus carry, what we are talking about, again, is a simple expansion of where existing behavior can take place, where somebody who is already allowed to carry a firearm can now carry where they could not before. And as the head of the Texas A&M University system told the state Senate there in Texas when the campus carry bill was being debated, why would we expect these concealed carry holders to behave any different on a college campus than off? He said, we don't have that expectation for any of our students, our faculty, our staff, that, once you get on a college campus, it's okay to be a drunken moron. It's okay to be irresponsible. It's okay to be dangerous. It's okay to be whatever, because, you know, now you're on a college campus and the rules don't really apply. We don't expect that of our students or our faculty, he said. And we don't expect it of our students or faculty who may be concealed carry holders. They're already behaving responsibly off campus. We would expect nothing else from them when they're on campus. And yet, despite that, I think, very common sense attitude, you know as well as I do that any effort to, again, expand where concealed carry holders can lawfully carry will be met with this same argument that we've heard for decades. We're seeing it right now with campus carry legislation in Georgia and campus carry legislation in Tennessee. We're seeing it in Kansas, where the campus carry legislation is scheduled to go into effect next year. We're seeing it in the state of Texas, where was a gun-free UT says they'll sue so they can try to keep concealed carry holders out of their classrooms. Even though these professors are, if they ever leave the confines of a college campus, in fact, if they ever leave their building, they are interacting, likely every day, interacting with concealed carry holders. I'm not sure if they're unaware of that fact or if they just try to suppress knowing that fact. Or maybe they just never leave the college campus. Maybe they're just too afraid to set foot off. Actually, again, in Texas already, the open areas of college campuses have been legal for concealed carry holders to carry there. So maybe they're just staying firmly ensconced in their building, have people bringing them food so they never have to leave. I doubt that's what's going on, though. But it is, again, good to see, at least on some level, the Austin American Statesman acknowledging that the hype was, in fact, exactly that. All right, Nick Adams from Retaking America. That's his new book, Crushing Political Correctness. Talked with Nick, I guess it was a couple weeks ago, about the upcoming book, but the release day is today, as a matter of fact. So we'll talk with Nick coming up right after a quick timeout here on this edition of NRA News Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler.
Speaking with Juliana Crowder with A Girl and a Gun. Juliana, welcome back to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing fabulous.
Tell folks, what is A Girl and a Gun?
A Girl and a Gun is an organization for women, and we get them out to the shooting range. We have activities for ladies who are brand new all the way through experienced shooters. So we offer kind of like a social club. But we also are being very serious about safety and training, and then also helping women reach certain goals with firearms that they might have.
Why did you start this?
It was really important for me to see more women out in the competitive shooting sports and also taking more responsibility for their personal safety. So I wanted to have kind of like a happy hour or a non-confrontational experience at the range.
Right.
So we just started hosting Girls Night Out and making it a social experience and then slowly introducing the more serious training aspect.
Well, whether it's shooting sports or hunting or anything, there's much more than just the aspect of picking up the gun. You're right. It's a social thing that involves friends, family, mentoring, whatever it involves, it's
right.
So important to make that work. Good. So just give us a flavor of some of the stuff you like to do.
So we like to go shoot IDPA and three gun. We have ladies going on hunts for the first time.
Cool.
We have ladies learning about archery.
All right, good.
We share experience about holsters, guns, different gear and equipment that might work better for certain body types.
A lot different for men and women.
And we're also sharing the emotional experience of being a firearms owner, because for some, it could be a traumatic transition from something that's happened in their life, and for others, it's a very joyful experience of liberation and empowerment. So we really are offering something for everyone.
Awesome. How can people get more information about A Girl and a Gun?
They can find us at agirlandagun.org, and we're also on Facebook.
Juliana Crowder, A Girl and a Gun, thank you so much for being on NRA News. You're always there for us, but thank you for what you do. Thank you for your passion. You keep it up, and we'll talk to you soon.
Oh, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Speaking with Dan Caporelli with Hire Our Heroes. Dan, welcome to NRA News. Tell us, what is Hire Our Heroes?
Yeah, so Hire Our Heroes is a nonprofit organization that basically helps transitioning veterans to position themselves for employment as they get out of the service.
Why'd you start this, Dan?
I served in the Marine Corps Reserves, and after 8 years, I got out thinking I had this great skill set. I was a satellite communications specialist, and shortly thereafter, long story short, there was really no opportunity for me to really find employment or anybody to help me find employment. So I felt like I was on an island by myself, and I thought if I couldn't be the only veteran going through this, that there was probably a need for a greater reach. And lo and behold, I gathered a few other veterans, and we formed Hire Our Heroes, basically founded by veterans for veterans.
That is great. So what's the reaction been to Hire Our Heroes?
You know, it's been phenomenal. It's one of those things, be careful what you wish for. The response has been overwhelming at times, but it has been nothing short of great and rewarding at the same time. There's nothing but opportunity for us to help veterans. And believe it or not, there's a lot of nonprofits out there, and these veterans still have a tough time really finding the right one that's going to bring them down the path to success as they transition out.
Dan,
feel like we've got a pretty cool tool set to do that.
Awesome. Dan Caporelli with Hire Our Heroes. How can folks get more information about the great work you're doing and your great organization?
Visit us on the web at hireourheroes.org, and they can fill out information on whether or not they're interested in transitioning, reaching for somebody to reach out for them to connect, as well as some of our other services and that we offer.
Dan Caporelli, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler. Rick Echter of Rick's Firearm Academy of Detroit will join us on the program right now. Little tease there with our bumper music. Nick Adams from Down Under, his brand new book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness. Nick's going to be with us here in just 1 second. The book, again, coming out now. And it's a good time to talk with Nick, because We are seeing here on the Twitterverse a number of individuals saying, I'm done with this because I'm not sure that Twitter is interested in a free and open dialogue as much as they are interested in policing speech. So Nick Adams, author of Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness, thank you, sir, for coming on the program. It's good talking with you again.
Brother Cam, it's always a pleasure. I thank you for your patriotism. I thank you for your energy, and it's always a great privilege to be able to join you and your patriotic listeners all around America.
Well, listen, we're always glad to get a chance to talk with you. Congratulations again on the official release of Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness. Congratulations. Absolutely. This is exciting stuff.
It is. It's out today. Today's the day, Cam, that it's been released, February 23. It's called Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness. If you love America and you hate political correctness, and I'm willing to wager that there's a fair few of your listeners, Cam, that feel that way, then this is a book for you. This is a how-to, a clarion call, a battle cry. This is a book I think that everybody needs to read because political correctness is absolutely strangling the United States. And anybody that cares about humanity, civilization, and America knows that the greatest moral imperative that we have right now on the 23rd of February 2016 is absolutely crushing this totalitarian ideology that is killing us.
All right, so let's get into some definitions here, Nick. Because I you know me, I'm a firm supporter of the Second Amendment. I believe in a robust Second Amendment. Frankly, I believe in a robust First Amendment and a Third Amendment, a Fourth Amendment. I'm a big fan of our individual liberties, all of them. And I recognize when it comes to freedom of speech and freedom of expression, that means that I am saying, yes, absolutely, people who disagree with me, people who hate my guts, have the freedom. They have the right to say in no uncertain terms how they feel about me and my ideas. I'm okay with that. I really, truly am. But what is political correctness as you define it?
Political correctness is intellectual tyranny. It is a totalitarian ideology, Cam, that seeks to change the way we speak, change the way we think, change the way we act, change the way we react. And it's part of a broader cultural mindset as well. You know, political correctness people only associate with limiting speech. That's a very, very significant part of it. But it's not the only part of it. Political correctness also, Cam, is behind the idea that no one culture is any better than any other. It is behind the idea that we should aspire to mediocrity and not greatness. It is behind the idea that we should only allow certain people to reach heights. It determines who's a victim and who's not. And so political correctness is much broader than just speech constraints. It is an ideology that is pushed upon us by moral and intellectual Lilliputians, pixies, that are insecure and that want to bring us down. You see, political correctness tries to do three things, Cam. It wants to remove individualism, remove confidence, and remove identity. And they're three things that America has always had in spades, and it's why political correctness has absolutely no time for America. But individualism, identity, and confidence is what makes America exceptional. Those three traits are indispensable to American greatness. And those three traits don't belong in Australia. They don't belong in England. They don't belong in Western Europe. They're gone. People are not allowed to have an identity. People are not allowed to be an individual. People are not allowed to be confident. And if they are, God help them, because they're going to get a terrible time from the media, from elites, from other people that are going to look to tear them down. So political correctness is about equalizing everyone, Cam. And, you know, it's a terrible thing because we're all individuals. God has got a different plan for all of us. And we should be free to live out our dreams. We should be free to pursue our happiness, just as is guaranteed in the Declaration of Independence.
You know, it's interesting. You use the phrase equalizing everyone, maybe homogenizing everyone would be a better phrase. Because I remember reading an article, and it's been several years. I couldn't even tell you where it was or who wrote it. But it approached the idea of political correctness, and I think it was a British author, because he said, you know what we don't have anymore? We don't have that quintessential British eccentric in society. You're not allowed to be eccentric. Eccentricity is now a bad thing, right? To be quirky. Yeah. Now, you can be acceptably quirky, but you can also be very unacceptably quirky. Everybody is sort of guided towards that cultural mean, right? And if you color outside of the lines at all, then you are to be otherized. You are to be unpersoned.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not welcome into polite society. You're right. I mean, political correctness has done away with characters. One of the things that I've always loved about life is meeting those people, Cam, that are larger than life, that are a little bit colourful in the language that they use, that are a little bit colourful in the things that they do, that, you know, can always bring you to laughter because they're so direct. And sadly, those people now are a dying breed because people say, well, you know what, I better not say that because I might get into trouble. And the last time I was on your show, we were speaking, Cam, and we spoke about how traditional people with traditional values and ideas have really now become the communists of today. You know, it wasn't that long ago that if you were a communist, you couldn't get a job and you missed out on opportunities and you were cancelled as a speaker on a college campus. Now it's exactly the opposite. Now if you hold a traditional view on marriage, if you don't subscribe to anthropogenic climate change, you know, if you happen to blaspheme against that green gay gospel, these guys are going to come after you with everything that they have. And it's not only unfair, it's not only wrong, it's un-American, it's anti-American. And fortunately, the only country, the only culture, the only people that can actually do something about this political correctness that aren't too far gone is America and our Americans.
You know, I think that you're really onto something here, Nick, because you talk about the traditionalists sort of being the communists of today. And in terms of the culture, I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, the sort of conservatarian or the conservative or the traditionalist, they are very much a counterculture compared to the dominant culture that we see from the, you know, New York, L.A., D.C.-based media. But you go back to let's go back to the 50s, right? What the left would consider the bad old days of McCarthyism. And one of the things that they never really acknowledge is the fact that you had a lot of criticism of McCarthy, right? In fact, you had public criticism of McCarthy in a way that you never would have seen in an actual communist country, right? They didn't have public criticism of Joseph Stalin because you got taken away. You got sent off to the gulag before you could even think about doing a thing like that. They went after a guy who saw communists under every rock and behind every tree because they lived in a nation that they had the freedom to do this. They had the freedom to say, this guy's a nutso. This guy's crazy, right? And anti-communists also had the freedom to say, well, look, there really were communists working in the U.S. government. There really were individuals in Hollywood who had, again, sworn this declaration to fealty to another country, not to the United States. This really did happen. But all of these existed in a place where we had the freedom to stand up and argue.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And the big point here, Cam, to make about everything that you've raised is that our thinking has changed. Our thinking has changed so substantially that, you know, without wanting to sound too much like Donald Trump, that we're not winning anymore. That you know, it's alpha Islam, beta Christianity. It's alpha everyone else, beta America. And that's not the right mindset. This is the greatest country in the history of the world. The Constitution is the best political document ever written. The United States military is the greatest military ever known to man. 75 years ago, to give you an indication, Cam, of how much our thinking has changed, 75 years ago, your country and mine interned Japanese, Italians, and Germans for practically no reason at all, other than they just wanted to be 100% sure that they could win the war. And, you know, if anybody were to raise the specter today of internment camps for Islamists, that we know for a fact, Cam, unlike in the Second World War with the Germans, the Italians and the Japanese in Australia and in America, we know that there are people of the Islamic faith in America right now that want to shoot us up, kill us, blow us up, set us on fire. But if anyone were to say, well, listen, why don't we have a think about internment camps? All of a sudden, utter pandemonium would break out. And that's because there's no moral clarity anymore. We couldn't win the Second World War today, Cam. We couldn't do it. We just could not win. We have become pansies. We have become pussycats. And meanwhile, these guys have an identity. These guys have the confidence. These guys are out there, and no wonder so many young Americans and Australians and Britons and Canadians are going to join these evil bastards at ISIS. They're doing it because they're the only guys that say, hey, here's an identity if you're interested in it. Might be evil, might be terrible, but at least it's an identity. It's something that you can celebrate. Meanwhile, we tell all of our young people, Cam, what a terrible country we are, how much we've got to be ashamed about, how we're hateful. And then we wonder why there's no allegiance anymore. We wonder why people are voting for a communist and socialist in the Democratic primary. I mean, it's just, it's incredible. Well, we've got to wake up to ourselves.
And I think part of the problem is that, you know, there is a mindset that refuses to acknowledge the fact that, and it's funny because this mindset, I think, generally is found among people who call themselves progressives. But they refuse to deny that we've made any real progress since, let's say, the 1940s, when we thought, all right, maybe we should round up Japanese and Germans and Italians and put them in internment camps so they can't do any harm. Not thinking about, again, the harm that might have been done by that action. I think we've made genuine progress since then. I think, and by the way, I think we've got no shortage of American men and women in our military who absolutely are itching to take the fight to those who want to kill
Without
us, who feel, you know, confined and restrained in that regard. But I think, again, you know, you point out the fact that, you know, in most of our, I shouldn't say most, in many of our history books, in many of our college classes, we aren't taught about the fact that America really is unique among other nations, that this was one of the few places on Earth in which a revolution transpired and you didn't have a horrific consequence as a result. You didn't have a terror established. What you had was a republic established and how unique that is in world history. We don't have that mindset when we're teaching our history. What we have is, well, this is another horrible place, Nick, and it was founded by horrible people who owned other human beings and therefore are irredeemable, and there's really nothing to be learned. And a matter of fact, you know, in all of human history, Nick, we right now, we the precious snowflakes, we are the best, we are the brightest, we are the most humane, we are the most tolerant, we are the most open-minded, we are the smartest, we are the greatest generation. I think we have that mindset right now among a lot of Americans who think that, don't even recognize that they're standing on the shoulders of giants, and assume that we can start with year zero because they know everything, including how to tell you and me how to live.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And let me tell you something right now, Cam. I can tell you, I mean, this is the best country in the world for anybody to live. This is the best country in the world for a black person to live. That's why more black Africans have come to America voluntarily than came as slaves. This is a country that has been absolutely destroyed by political correctness to the point where all of this mythology has come out. And because political correctness, the casualty of it is not just freedom, Cam, but it's truth and it's reality and it's confidence. And that's what I'm trying to do with my book, Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness. I'm trying to get Americans to know the truth, to know that they're part of the best country in the world, to know that they are indispensable to Western civilization, that they're indispensable to humanity as we know it, to tell them to be proud, to tell them to repel this politically correct garbage that is being shoved down our throats. Let's punch the bully in the nose and let's do away with this awful, awful ideology that doesn't allow us to beat our enemies, that doesn't allow us to win, that doesn't allow us to be ourselves. Screw it. That's not America. They can stick it up their backside.
Nick Adams, the new book is Retaking America, Crushing Political Correctness. Nick, thank you so much, sir, for coming on the program. We've got to run, but we wish you the best of luck with the new book.
Brother Cam, always a pleasure.
Thank you, sir. Nick Adams with us. Sort of on a similar note, our friends at the Rebel up in Canada, James Campbell, The Rise of the Alpha Homo, European Gay Men as the Right's New Heroes, talking about, in part, Milo Yiannopoulos, who, again, is making a pretty good career of being politically incorrect and defying cultural expectations, perhaps on the right and the left. You know, maybe that author, I wish I could remember where this was that I read a few years ago, who bemoaned the demise of the British eccentric in society. Maybe we're starting to see a little bit of a resurgence of that. I hope so, anyway. The world is a much more interesting place when we are all able to speak our mind. Everybody. Again, including the people who disagree with me. I think it's much better when we have a conversation rather than a shushing. All right. When we come back after a timeout, Rick Echter from Rick's Farm Academy of Detroit will join us. We'll talk about the growing number of concealed carry holders in the state of Michigan and one news report that says there's also a growing number of violent crimes committed by concealed carry holders. We'll break down the numbers with Rick right after this here on NRA News, Cam and Company.
I believe we had the former governor of Texas,
like,
Rick Perry.
Like busting up a,
that's who
a,
it looks
a,
like. Governor, I'm Steve Holbrook. Great to see you.
Steve, people say that all the time. They say, man, you know, you look like the former governor of Texas.
Yeah, yes, sir.
I get that. Then I find out whether or not they actually liked him or not.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
if they did, it's good. Well, yeah, I'm. That's who I am.
Well, Governor, it's good to see you.
Yeah, you know, that guy's kind of...
How are you doing today?
I'm awesome, man. You kidding? Being at the SHOT Show?
How could you not be doing well,
How can you not be doing good here?
So next question, what are you doing here?
No, the question ought to be, why have you not been here every year in a row for the last 14 years? I mean, why did you miss any?
Right.
This is LaRue Tactical, one of my hometown boys, Leander, Texas. Mark LaRue is a great friend. I'm doing an event this afternoon with them. We're giving a LaRue OBR to the Sniper of the Year, a Marine. A young Marine will have a new weapon moving towards their possession as soon as we get to the appropriate place to register it
right.
properly.
Excellent. That is fantastic.
Yeah.
So this is your first time at SHOT Show? No? You've been before?
I've been before.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Well, and it gets bigger and better. I'm here with a friend who came at one of the first SHOT Shows. Like, I don't know how long they've been going on. This is like 14 years ago he came to the first one. He said, just in the last two or three years. Now, I don't know. Was it because we got a resident of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue that has created a lot of interest in owning weapons and tactical gear and what have you to defend your freedom and your family? I don't know, but whatever
reason, I have something
to
do with it.
It's been good for our country's economy. A lot of people in Texas, my home state, and a lot of people in some of those even blue states, men and women have really good jobs because they're manufacturing goods that have been innovated right here because of the interaction that happened at the SHOT Show. And so I happen to look at the American defense industry, the American hunting industry, the American home defense industry as a great job creator for America based on our Constitution. Now, what could be better than that?
You know, I can't think of too many things, but the anti-gun advocates, they say maybe we should be making tofu or, close down the gun industry.
I'm looking for tofu in the Constitution. I hadn't found that
I
yet.
I believe it's an emanation of a penumbra it's a dangling participle or something.
Maybe First Amendment freedom.
Yeah.
So, Governor, how concerned are you right now? I mean, we've got Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Bernie Sanders. They're all saying that, they're trying to out anti-gun each other. together right now. So this is going to be a huge campaign issue for them. At the same time, you know, look, we've got millions of Americans who are becoming concealed carry holders. I think support for the Second Amendment is strong. Do you think that Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and the other anti-gun folks, are they misreading the electorate, or are they just hoping to drag us all along to their point of view?
I don't know whether misreading the electorate or not, but this coming November, the American people need to send a powerful message to both political parties, frankly. We obviously, I feel very comfortable that the Republican nominee, whoever that individual will be a powerful proponent of the Second Amendment and defending our gun rights. Mm-hmm. But we need to be sending a message across the board that this issue is settled, that this isn't up for debate anymore. I mean, the idea that the Democrats somehow think, or Hillary Clinton, let me put it that way, I don't want to defend. I mean, there's some really
there
good Democrats out there.
I mean,
there's
absolutely
a lot of good Democrats out there that are supporters of our Second Amendment and our gun rights, and God bless them for that. I hope they'll take the opportunity this election cycle to realize this may be the most important issue that they face when it comes to our freedoms and our liberties in this country, is defending Americans' rights to defend themselves, the families. And Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Ed Al have made it clear that they'd like for us to be a lot more like Australia than America.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Still to come on the program, Barca Herman from Her Rights, Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. And right now, I want to welcome to the program Mr. Rick Echter from Rick's Farm Academy of Detroit. How you doing, Rick?
Hey, man, I am great right now because I just left the gun range with two of my buddies, and we threw 1,000 rounds of lead downrange today. It's sunny. It's relatively warm for a February day. However, we're mindful that we're expecting 6 to 10 inches come Thursday. So if I'm going to feel good, I better feel good today.
Well, listen, I'm glad you're having a good day. It's always good to get a little range time in. And it's interesting to note, so Rick and two of his friends just went to the range and used up about 1,000 rounds while practicing at the range, okay? Because, Rick, as you know, we've got anti-gun advocates who say you should maybe be allowed to own 50 rounds of ammunition at a time.
You know, 50 rounds wouldn't get me through like a day of just maintenance shooting. You know, if I wasn't a firearms instructor, 50 rounds would be like the absolute minimum. You know, minimum, if you don't do anything, do 50 rounds a month. You know, easily 100 a month. But, you know, these people who think that, you know, eyebrows should be raised because someone has a couple of thousand rounds of ammo is crazy. You know, ammo, you know, for all the people who are, like, new to guns, make sure you let them know that by the time the presidential election rolls around in November, that if they don't have at least a couple of thousand rounds of their most favorite size caliber ammunition on hand, it might be a while before they can buy some.
Absolutely. All right. So listen, I want to ask you about this story at MLive.com. Here's the headline. Arrests of CPL holders spike as permits in Michigan hit a record high. Rick, I'm sure you've had a chance to read the story. You're quoted in the story. What do you, before we get into some of the specifics, generally speaking, what did you think about this piece?
It was basically a piece that was really not accurately told. Here's the thing. CPL holders, you know, across the nation and specifically Michigan, because our state police keeps the statistics on their website, which is publicly viewable by anyone with an internet-enabled device. We're the most law-abiding sector of America, of our states, amongst gun owners, even amongst the general population, and even more law-abiding statistically than law enforcement officers. You know, anytime you look at any sample of a specific population, there's going to be a minuscule population who, for whatever reason, is going to run into an infraction of some sort. Okay. So if we look at the stats and we're less than 0.5% of infractions, you know, whether it's even, you know, something worthy of talking about. Maybe I carried my gun and I forgot to put my CPL license in my wallet or something along those lines. You know, it's really, you know, people trying to make a big deal out of nothing. We have a record number of arrests because we have a record number of CPL holders in the state of Michigan. We just crossed the 500,000 threshold for CPL holders in Michigan. You know, it's not a whole lot in the big scheme of things when you figure our state has about 14 million people. But, hey, you know, we're making headway. More people are embracing their right to keep and bear arms and to have a means of defending themselves against violent offenders. But by and large, the still proportionate amount of people that run into an infraction is relatively minuscule. And this story in of itself is, I call it yellow journalism. One, they took a cheap shot at the fact that we repealed our 83-county gun boards in the state. You know, they were preaching that people who were statutorily not supposed to have guns were somehow going to slip in the cracks and get them. That has not been proven true. And also they wanted to take a dig at some legislation that was recently introduced to go to constitutional carry. So if they can use statistics to paint a misleading story to lead the fight against constitutional carry, well, that's what those anti-gun folks are going to do. The story was a bunch about nothing.
You know, and it's interesting because they threw out a lot of statistics at the beginning of this story. They said from 2004 to 2014, the number of CPLs in Michigan increased from 110,777 to 440,006, a 297% increase. During that same time period, violent crime charges against CPL holders annually increased from 34 to 232. They say a 582% jump, according to Michigan State Police statistics. So 232 violent crime charges against the, roughly 516,000 CBL holders now in the state. To give you an idea, on average, in the state of Michigan, we're talking about somewhere around 40, over the last 5 years, somewhere around 45,000 violent crimes being committed. During that 10-year time period that MLive talked about, 542,142 violent crimes were committed, Rick. Nearly 500,000 violent crimes were committed in the state of Michigan. Again, you talk about concealed carry holders being far more law-abiding than the general population. Well, there you go. You know, again, this is these types of crimes are an infinitesimally small number. And despite the increase, they remain an infinitesimally small number compared to the number of crimes that are committed in Michigan.
Exactly. It throws some statistics out there, scares some people, and scare people out of their rights and scare any potential advances that may occur down the road, because we know a certain segment of the population hates math. So let's throw some stats out there and scare folks.
Yeah. And by the way, these are charges, not convictions, it should be noted.
Exactly.
There was one other thing that I thought was sort of conspicuously absent in this story, and that's the recent individual. They do profile a concealed carry holder who was found guilty of a second-degree murder. They don't talk about the recent concealed carry holder in Warren, Michigan, who's, I think, being honored today, Rick, by the city for coming to the aid of a woman who was being stabbed by her daughter. This guy, a concealed carry holder, and he's being honored by the city of Warren, Michigan. But that
Absolutely.
That story didn't even, and no other armed citizen stories made it into
it
this piece.
It wasn't even mentioned. There were no other stories, high-profile stories that were mentioned. You know, I don't think I'm exaggerating if I say that the state of Michigan, and particularly the greater Detroit area, is perennially leading the nation in people who are lawfully carrying firearms, who actually have documented cases in which they're actually using them. You know, when you get politicians, they go out into rural America and they say, hey, national crime stats have been trending down for decades. What do we need all these guns for? Well, unfortunately, those of us who don't have the privilege of living in rural America. We live in a concentrated environment in which there is a plethora and myriad number of bad guys who are only too selfishly willing to commit violent crimes against innocent people. So, yes, the article was slanted in the fact that it didn't list not even one case of a justified use of a firearm. And, yeah, that Warren, Michigan case, it garnered a lot of attention nationally. And the big reason why was because that guy was actually fired from his job right after he saved that woman's life. Once the blowback, you know, from the media and politicians got involved, mm-hmm. you know, GM did an about face and gave that man his job back. And because of that young man, I'm so glad he stepped in, because we wouldn't have that woman he saved. She wouldn't be here anymore.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Rick, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir, and I've got to ask, I mean, what are you seeing in terms of your classes right now? Is demand
It's really growing. It's skyrocketing. It's hit a different level. It's only going to get more pronounced as we get closer to November during the presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
I'm certain we'll be hearing a lot about gun control and gun rights, and that's even going to push the demand for training even higher. You know, fortunately for me, I've been training a lot of people to be National Rifle Association certified firearms instructors. So hopefully there'll be enough instructors out here to reach the demand.
All right, Rick. Listen, thanks so much for coming on the program, sir. It's always good talking with you.
Always a pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you guys in Louisville.
Yes, sir. We'll see you there. Rick Ector from Rick's Firearm Academy in Detroit joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. In the state of Michigan, by the way, in 2014, there were a total of 535 homicides reported. That is the lowest number of homicides in the state since 1966. Lowest number of homicides in over 40 years. A homicide rate of 5.4%. Which is also the lowest since 1966 in the state of Michigan. And again, none of that mentioned here in this article at MLive, focusing instead on the arrests. They say, and they end this piece, they say a total of 398 CPL holders were charged in 2003-2004 for all crimes, including less serious offenses. That number rose by more than 11 times to 4,421 charges in 2013-2014. Now, again, these are charges. These are all charges for all crimes, including nonviolent crimes. 4,421 charges. There were, in the state of Michigan in 2014, 272,583 crimes. Now, if I'm doing my math correctly, that means that concealed carry holders were charged, 0.016% of all crimes in the state of Michigan in 2014. You just don't get that sense. You don't get the perspective. Because nowhere in this story does the reporter bother to mention the total number of crimes being committed in the state of Michigan. One might think that if you were trying to educate your audience, you would want to give them some perspective. You'd maybe want to include the total number of crimes, since you are saying, listen, here's how many crimes concealed carry holders were charged with. Here are the total number of crimes in the state of Michigan. That information apparently not important enough to include in the story. Wonder why. All right, coming up next hour, Barker Herman, who is offering free firearms training. Cameron, did you put this in the rundown specifically as a tongue twister in hopes that I would read this and get tongue twisted?
I didn't, but next time I will. It's a good idea.
Free. Here's what it says on my rundown. It says right here. Free firearms training for females in Florida flourishes.
You can blame bearing
say
arms
five
for that.
Times fast. Darn that Jen Jakes. She did it on purpose. I know she did it on purpose. Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation going to join us on the program coming up in hour three, or excuse me, in hour two. In hour three, we have the deal of the day. We have the hero of the day, good guy of the day. Coming up at the top of the hour, you know, yesterday we were talking about Joe Biden and his speech on the floor of the Senate in 1992, in which he said, listen, we're too far into the election year here. Any sort of nomination would just be inappropriate at this point in time. President Bush shouldn't make a nomination because we're right in the middle of election season, and there's no way that this is going to be anything other than a political circus. There's no way that we're going to be able to confirm a nominee, even a good one. Both sides, he said, are going to act poorly. He's trying to defend his comments here, but now another comment, another argument by Joe Biden in opposition to nominating a Supreme Court justice so close to an election has popped up. Talk about that coming to the top of the hour. Stick around. Hour 2 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is on the way.
I'm here with Ashley Levinsky. She is the curator of the Cody Fires Museum. Ashley, good to see you again. Thanks for being back on NRA News.
Thank you for having me.
Now, last time when we talked to you, our good friend Phil Schreier was here. He's not here this time, so I have you all to myself.
Oh, yeah. We don't have any guns today.
I know. That's okay. We're going to talk all about the museum. It's such a cool place, and you're such a great representative of the Cody Firearms Museum. So tell folks, what is the Cody Firearms Museum?
Oh, man. The Cody Firearms Museum is actually, it's one of five major museums at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West, and we also have a huge research library, and there are guns in every single museum. But the Cody Firearms Museum has 7,000 firearms, and they start all the way back to 1425, and they go up through modern day. And so there's literally something for every interest. We've got, obviously, the American West guns being in Cody, Wyoming. But then we've also got an extensive military history collection, embellished arms collection, Hollywood guns, you name it, it's there.
And I love, Ashley, how there's such an integral part of American history, how you can tell the history of the country through its firearms, starting all the way from 1425. Yeah, all the way up. It's so great.
Well, you know, it's so interesting to me because when we got our start, you know, we were the Winchester Arms Museum, and that came from the Winchester Collection, which was loaned and then donated to us. But it was always, you know, so much more than just, you know, the American West. I mean, the American Western story just was international to the Winchester Company. And so they collected international firearms. They collected historic firearms that predated Winchester, obviously, of 1425. And so, you know, they recognized how important this firearm story was all over the world and how it impacted the American West. And so it's amazing that you could literally take one firearm and just tell so many different stories.
And you guys are going to tell, like my good friend Phil Schreier, we always say, if that firearm could only talk.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And what would it say? So when you guys get together with Phil and your other curators, you know, we've got 7,000 firearms. Well, I got 10,000. You guys ever get into any contest or anything?
Yeah, it's usually more like, oh, you got that gun? You want to loan it over here? Loan that one?
It's like a poker game.
It really is. But, you know, what's so great is that I love that the museums really complement each other. I mean, they've got some... I actually had to laugh. I went down to the NRA Museum's booth, you know.
Right.
And they had... Right now, they're displaying one of Eisenhower guns and one of JFK's guns. Well, so are we. We did not plan that at all.
I love it. That's so great. Well, you know, so tell folks some of the most compelling stories and stories about some of the firearms you have. So stuff that's really piqued your interest.
You know, I'll talk about the first gun that I worked on back 5 years ago when I first came to the Cody Firearms Museum. And it was a Colt 1861 Navy, and it was serial number one.
Of course. That always helps.
Yeah, original leather holster. And, you know, first off, I mean, you know the 61's great, and it's got this great history, but, you know, it was one of 100 made with a fluted cylinder, so it had that kind of rarity to it. And then it also, we knew who it belonged to. And not only did we know who it belonged to, it wasn't given to like a general or something. It was a private who happened to buy it. It was made on April 9th. They actually wrote the date underneath the strap. And so it was April 9th, 1861. And his name is Caleb Slate. And Caleb Slate enlisted in this American Civil War in, I think, May 20th or 21st of that year. And so he just happened across number one.
Wow.
And the fact that we can then trace that gun through the American Civil War, and then the history kind of gets fuzzy until it ended up at an auction. Someone bought it and then put it on loan to us. And to me, to see one a significant model, you know, with its own technological history, but then you have the military side of it. And then to find an actual soldier and a personal connection to it just doesn't get much
better.
Awesome.
How can we get more information about the museum?
All right. Well, you can go to thecenterofthewest.org. You can actually read about all five of our museums, and we're at Cody Firearms on Twitter.
Ashley, thank you so much for being on NRA
News.
Thank
you for having me.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Barker Herman, firearms instructor with the group Her Rights, offering free firearms training for females in Florida. That is flourishing, by the way. Also, Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation says the Obama administration would like to make sure that the non-citizens are voting in the upcoming election. What are they doing in order to make that possible? We'll talk with Hans later in the hour. Hero of the day coming up at the top of hour three. Deal of the day, good guy of the day, Chris Chang with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties. And Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum coming up next hour as well. Now, yesterday on the program, we shared with you a clip that C-SPAN had unearthed of Joe Biden, then a senator from Delaware, in 1992, June of 1992, in the thick of the presidential election year, on the floor of the Senate, saying, listen, if somebody steps down from the Supreme Court, I don't think that the president should nominate anybody. And if he does nominate somebody, I really don't think we should have any hearings. Huh. Why? Well, we're in the thick of an election year. And there's no way the process isn't going to be politicized. Good nominee, bad nominee, meh nominee, doesn't matter. Because they're all going to get chewed up by the system. It's all going to become political. It's just better for the president to wait until the next president. And he said, you know, listen, I'm not saying this for political expediency's sake. I'm just saying it because it's the right thing to do. So how do you get out of this one? Well, let's see. Over at Think Progress, who's the author of this piece here? Igor Volsky. Says, Biden's full speech undermines this claim. Rather than urging his colleagues to deny Bush's potential nominee a hearing, Biden was bemoaning the politicization of the confirmation process, hence his suggestion of not holding a hearing in the heat of a presidential election, and what he saw as Bush's refusal to properly consult with the Senate in selecting a nominee. Now, keep in mind, this is all a hypothetical that Biden's talking about. There was no resignation. So this was Biden's hypothetical. Biden was responding to Bush's hypothetical refusal to properly consult with the Senate in selecting a hypothetical nominee that did not actually exist. That's the argument from Think Progress's Igor Volsky. In fact, he says, just 10 minutes after calling for a temporary inaction on Bush's candidate, again, the hypothetical candidate that didn't exist, Biden actually promised to consider a moderate Supreme Court nominee. Saying, quote, I believe that so long as the public continues to split its confidence between the branches, compromise is the responsible course both for the White House and for the Senate. Therefore, I stand by my position, Mr. President, if the president consults and cooperates with the Senate or moderates his selections absent consultation, then his nominees may enjoy my support, as did Justices Kennedy and Souter. So the defense of Joe Biden's remarks is, well, he also said something different in that very same speech 10 minutes later. So there. Now, again, I'm not sure that's a great defense for the vice president. Just give him 10 minutes and he'll say something completely the opposite of what he's just said. But here's the thing. He also made similar comments in an interview with E.J. Dionne at the Washington Post. Ed Morrissey wrote about this at Hot Air. Here's a quote. Actually, let me read to you from the Washington Post piece. And this was, again, 1992, June of 92. E.J. Dionne wrote, if a new high court vacancy occurs, the president, Biden said, should be prepared to compromise with the Senate not only on the identity of a nominee, but also on the question of what judicial philosophy should be reflected on the court. Quote, unless the president is willing to actually sit down with and compromise with the Senate beforehand, it is bound, guaranteed, that there will be a serious fight no matter who is sent. E.J. Dionne went on to write, Biden said he had no knowledge of whether any member of the high court planned to resign this year and added that he hoped no one would. But if a vacancy occurred, he warned that any nominee would face a harrowing experience. And here's the second quote from Biden in this piece. Quote, if someone steps down, I would highly recommend the president not name someone, not send a name up. If he, Bush, did send someone up, I would ask the Senate to seriously consider not having a hearing on that nominee, he said. Now, again, Dionne quotes both of these statements from Biden as well. But Biden starts out in Dionne's interview. Biden starts out by saying, unless the president is actually willing to sit down and compromise with the Senate beforehand, it's bound guaranteed there will be a serious fight. So you know what? I wouldn't do it. That's where he's going there. Yeah, he could sit down, he could talk, he could do all of these things that we know he's not going to do, right? Sit down and let us make the pick for him. Or if he did send someone, I would ask the Senate to seriously not have any hearing on that nominee. I'd highly recommend the president not even nominate somebody. If he did, I'd recommend we not even have a hearing. Now, some of this sounds a little bit like a politician trying to have it both ways. Right? But it also does sound like Joe Biden is saying, unless the president meets these preconditions, which he's not going to meet, allowing the Senate to pick the nominee's judicial philosophy. Do you think President Obama, by the way, is going to meet with that? You think if the Senate said, all right, listen, we'll hold hearings as long as your pick is a originalist, is a textualist, comes from the Scalia vein. Sure, we'll hold hearings. You think Obama would go for that? Of course not. Any more than George W. Bush would have gone for letting Joe Biden pick the judicial philosophy of his Supreme Court candidate. So Biden sets up these unrealistic demands, and then failing to meet those unrealistic demands, best thing to do would be not to nominate anybody. And if he did nominate somebody, knowing the way the Senate works, not how we want it to work, but knowing the way the Senate works, I'd have to say we don't have hearings. And by the way, Biden was the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1992. He was the one in charge of holding hearings, had a nominee, had there been a resignation, had a nominee taken place. He went on to say, quote, can you imagine dropping a nominee after three or four or five decisions that are about to be made by the Supreme Court into that fight, into that cauldron, in the middle of a presidential year? I believe there would be no bounds of propriety that would be honored by either side. The environment within which such a hearing would be held would be so supercharged and so prone to be able to be distorted. Whoever the nominee was, good, bad, or indifferent, will become a victim. Now, let me just ask this. What is different about the 2016 election that makes it less of a cauldron? What is different about our politics in 2016, where all of a sudden the vice president says, you know what, I bet there would be some bounds of propriety that would be recognized by both sides, even in the middle of this election year, where you've got the left and the right not only fighting to pick their own candidates, but waging internecine, intra-party battles as well, on both sides. What makes you think that 2016 would be any better in terms of a political environment for a nominee? In 1992, Joe Biden said it would be unfair to whoever the nominee would be, good, bad, or indifferent. They would become a victim. But now that Biden's the vice president, doesn't have much concern for that victim, does he? No, just go ahead. We should really do it. Think Progress had a statement from Biden. Nearly a quarter century ago, in June of 1992, I gave a lengthy speech on the Senate floor about a hypothetical vacancy on the Supreme Court. Some critics say the one excerpt of my speech is evidence that I oppose filling a Supreme Court vacancy in an election year. This, he says, is not an accurate description of my views on the subject. Indeed, he says, as I conclude in the same statement critics are pointing to today, urge the Senate and White House to work together to overcome partisan differences to ensure the court functions as the Founding Fathers intended. That remains my position today. Well, that actually wasn't what he was arguing in 1992. It wasn't what he was arguing to his speech on the Senate. It wasn't what he was arguing in his interview with E.J. Dionne. He was perhaps using the political dysfunction as a starting off point to say how he wishes things would be, again, that the president would consult with the party not in power in the Senate. And, the president of the opposing party would consult with the party in power in the Senate on not just a name, but a judicial philosophy for the nominee. And failing that, that reform of the process, where all of a sudden now the president goes to the opposing party in the Senate and says, who do you want? What type of judicial philosophy should they have, you think? And unless he accedes to their demands, what does Biden say should happen? Nothing should happen. The president shouldn't send a nominee if he's not going to bend over backwards with the Senate. And if the president does send a nominee after not having bent over backwards to acquiesce to the Senate's wishes, then the Senate should not hold hearings. That was his position in 1992. No, that's not his position in 2016. But that was exactly what his position was when it was President George H.W. Bush and the candidate was Bill Clinton. And there's no other way to read it. I'm sorry, there is no other way to read this. The other way to read this would be that you have a politician who literally can't keep track of what he is saying 10 minutes apart in his own speech. That he'll take two completely contradictory points of view in the same speech. But that still doesn't explain his interview with E.J. Dionne and the comments that he made, the very similar comments that he made. Let's see, more from this E.J. Dionne piece. Actually, he started talking about the Clarence Thomas hearings, the Anita Hill hearings. Biden said the battle for control of the court had become so bitter that liberals and conservatives seemed prepared to use any means necessary to win confirmation battles. Quote, both sides are so self-righteous that it truly is the ends justify the means, Biden said. I do not regret at all not having used the same tactics. Huh. So in 1992, Biden said, you know, those crafty Republicans, it's always about the ends justifying the means. And so any behavior is fine and dandy, right, as long as you're working towards an end. But I didn't fall for that. I stood on principle, he said, and I don't regret not having used those tactics. I don't regret for a moment acknowledging that the means are the ends. The means are important in and of themselves, and you can't subvert democracy simply to try to get your way. Is this what I suppose the narrative would be, that Biden is now, quote unquote, grown in office, right? Not that he's saying something completely different, but now he's learned the careful art of statesmanship, right? Seasoned after several more decades in Washington, D.C. Still doesn't change the fact that what he said in 1992 is pretty clearly not what he's saying right now. Even when we're talking about, again, not just a hypothetical situation as we were in 1992, but the reality of what Biden was warning about more than two decades ago. So far, by the way, we do not have a name for a nominee for Barack Obama, but we certainly will let you know as soon as one is released. Meanwhile, the current head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley, on the floor of the Senate, talking about to Justice Antonin Scalia and his role in protecting individual liberties. Now, again, if the Biden of 92 would have advised the president at the time, go to the Senate, listen to their concerns, ask the Senate what type of judicial philosophy a nominee should have if they're going to have a chance of confirmation, then if you do those things, maybe you'll get the Senate to go along. That would mean pretty clearly that you're talking about somebody in the same judicial mold as Antonin Scalia. And not somebody who would proclaim a fealty to the ideas of originalism and textualism at this late date, but someone that you could point to throughout their judicial career, their academic career, and say, look, this individual's been consistent in this position. Again, I don't think that's likely to happen from this president. But Charles Grassley said it's important to show how many times that Justice Scalia was part of a 5-4 majority that upheld or even expanded individual rights. He said if someone other than Justice Scalia had served on the court, individual liberty would have paid the price. He said the first time Justice Scalia played such a pivotal role for liberty was in a takings clause case under the Fifth Amendment. He ruled that when a state imposes a condition on a land use permit, the government must show a close connection between the impact of the construction and the permit condition. Even though I disagreed, Senator Grassley said, he ruled that the First Amendment's free speech clause prohibits the states or the federal government from criminalizing burning of the flag. Congress cannot, he concluded, claim power under the Commerce Clause to criminalize an individual's ownership of a firearm in a gun-free school zone. Justice Scalia was part of a 5-member majority that held under the free speech clause that a public university cannot refuse to allocate a share of student activity funds to religious publications when it provides funds to secular publications. He found the 10th Amendment prohibits Congress from commandeering state and local officials to enforce federal laws. The court, in a 5-4 ruling, including Justice Scalia, concluded that it did not violate the First Amendment's Establishment of Religion Clause for public school teachers to teach secular subjects in parochial schools as long as there is no excessive entanglement between the state and the religious institution. Justice Scalia believed that the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial requires certain sentencing factors be charged in the indictment and submitted to a jury to decide, rather than a judge. He concluded with four other justices that the First Amendment's freedom of expression allowed the Boy Scouts to exclude from its membership individuals who would affect the ability of the group to advocate public or private views. Showing that original intent can't be lampooned for failing to take technological changes into account, Justice Scalia wrote the court's majority opinion, holding that under the Fourth Amendment, police can't use thermal imaging technology or other technology not otherwise available to the general public for surveillance of a person's home, even without physical entry without a warrant. He went on, by the way, Senator Grassley did. If you go to Senator Grassley's website, grassley.senate.gov, in the news releases, I would encourage you to read the entire thing because that was a small sample of the judicial temperament and the judicial philosophy espoused by Antonin Scalia. Now, again, if the president were to say, you know what? That's who I want on the bench. I want somebody who thinks just like that. You know, maybe you would hear calls for hearings. Maybe Senator Grassley might even say, you know, just like Senator Biden when he was the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, president talked to us, asked what we wanted. We told him what we wanted. He's trying to give us what we wanted. So sure, we'll hold hearings. But again, I don't think there was a serious suggestion from Joe Biden in 1992. And I don't think you would be entertained for a moment by Barack Obama. So we are left again with the other option expressed by Joe Biden in 1992. What happens if the president doesn't bend over backwards for the Senate in terms of a Supreme Court nominee? Senate shouldn't act. That's what the vice president said. All right, when we come back after a quick timeout, Barca Herman of Her Rights will join us on the program, offering free firearms training down in Florida. 20 spaces were open. 900 women applied. How about that? We'll talk with Barca right after this quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler.
Speaking with Jim Sapieca, director of the NRA Museums. Jim, in this installment, we want to talk about the NRA National Sporting Arms Museum. Tell us what it's all about.
Well, that is the newest of our three museums. We have the NRA National Firearms Museum here at NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia. The NRA National Sporting Arms Museum was opened 2 years ago at the Bass Pro Shops in Springfield, Missouri, and it is a spectacular museum. There are about 1,000 historic arms there, and of course, as you'd guess, there's an emphasis on sporting arms, the arms of hunting, of sport shooting. But it goes far, far beyond that. We have exhibits that include guns of the Old West. We've got some great new guns that are just coming in and will be on display soon. Bat Masterson, Bass Reeves, who is a very iconic Old West figure, the first African-American U.S. Marshal west of the Mississippi, and one of the most prolific lawmen of the Old West in terms of number of arrests, number of gunfights, a remarkable Old West figure that has been mostly overlooked until just the past few years. That museum, the really gratifying thing about that museum is the attendance. We just hit a milestone, opened 2 years and 2 months, and we have had 700,000 people through that museum. And so it's almost 1,000 a day. Yeah. Oh. And the demographics there, we get a lot of families, a lot of, mom, dad, and the kids coming through. Right. And it's just great. And you see the parents pointing out the different things to the kids, and then the kids taking them by the hand and saying, come over here and see this.
How do we get more info about that museum?
That museum, all the NRA museums are at the website, nramuseums.com, or you can go visit the museum in Springfield, Missouri at the Bass Pro headquarters shop there. It's open every day of the year except Christmas, and admission is always free at all three of the NRA museums.
What kind of government cares more about appeasing Islamic terrorists than defending the constitutional rights of its citizens? A government that would disarm us during the age of terror. Nothing would make us more vulnerable to generations of suffering and slaughter than the destruction of our Second Amendment. But many of our politicians, aided by a relentless media, are launching that attack themselves. They dream of joining the rest of the disarmed peoples of the world, entrusting our survival to the mercy of monsters. The greatest damage the terrorists could ever inflict upon us is disarmament at the hands of the political elites. But we will never offer our right to survive as a fool's ransom to the world's killers. Our freedom is what they fear most. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I know you're watching, so pay attention. You hate my freedom, my religion, and my country. You hate me for speaking my mind. You try to control me with violence and intimidation. You think you can muzzle me with fear? Don't ever confuse me for my politicians or my media. I am an American, free-born and free-bred, and I will call you out for who you are, an Islamic extremist who would kill me for my beliefs. You don't intimidate me. My freedom is more powerful than anything you can possibly do, and I will never, never surrender my rights to your terror. I will say what I think, worship according to my beliefs, and raise my children how I see fit, and I defend it all with the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. I cower to no one. Because I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I am freedom's safest place.
Your source for, your first source for Second Amendment news and information, it is NRA News, Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host. We are not walking on sunshine in Farmville today. We are walking on very wet pavement. It is raining again. It is soggy. It's like Seattle of the East Coast here in Farmville. Only we don't have an extra tax on our firearms ammunition here. Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation coming up in just a little bit. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from Her Rights, Barca Herman is with us. Barca, thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. I read about your story from Jen Jakes at Bearing Arms. you had offered a 20... spots for free firearms training for women there in what part of Florida are you in?
So we're in South Florida. The classes are held in Palm Beach County, and we serve Broward and Palm Beach counties, and there's often some people from Miami-Dade County that show up as well.
So. Okay, so 20 spots free of charge.
Yeah,
you had 900.
More than 900 people signed up on Facebook.
Just on Facebook?
Yes.
Wow. All right, Varga, is this typical? Is this normal when
it's
you
not,
do something like this?
It's not. We've been offering these classes for more than 2 years now, and you know the average is about 15 people show up to the classes, and a lot more people say they would show up on Facebook than do show up. That's how it is, you know, in
sure.
social media. But you know, when it started reaching 900, we had to do something about it. So, yeah, so that just goes to show you that there's a lot of women who are interested.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've got to ask, I mean, how did you get into gun ownership and then becoming a firearms instructor?
So, for me, it's not just about gun ownership and firearms, even though I think it's an extremely amazing tool to talk about freedoms. So, you know, I wanted to do something that was empowering for women, and I kept thinking, how am I going to go about doing this? And one of the fastest ways, I think, is to go out shooting, get more women involved in it, because then it becomes, you know, less of a, you know, the stereotypical white male hunting issue, which I don't think it is at all. It's got nothing to do with that. So that was one of my goals. And then the second thing is, how do you talk to women who are busy raising families and, you know, taking care of children, working, taking care of all the stuff, interested in freedom and rights. And I think that gun ownership is a great way to start that conversation. So.
That's really interesting.
Plus it's fun.
Plus it's fun. There you go.
Yeah.
So you talk about the number of women that you're seeing here. Is this a spike? Is this a fad you think we're seeing, or has there been a slow, steady increase in the number of women that you've seen there in South Florida who are either interested in exercising their rights, or they've already made that decision? All right, you know what? I am going to be a gun owner. I am going to be a concealed carry holder.
So, you know, I don't want to really talk about statistics and trends because I'm not an expert, but I can give you an insight from what I've seen over the more than 2 years that I've been doing this.
Sure.
That, you know, there is an increased interest from when I started. I do feel that there's an increased interest. The last 8 years help, you know, where, you know, there's always some story in the news about how it's a right that, you know, is in danger. So I think that has a little bit to do with it. But also, I think that if you look at what's going on with the election cycle this year, I think people are interested in becoming more free, and people are interested in, stepping out on their own and being more independent. And that's one of the reasons why you see on both sides of the aisles people just, not going along with establishment, so
mm-hmm.
to speak.
No, I think you're absolutely onto something there. And to that point, there does seem to also be a concerted campaign by anti-gun activists to tell women, don't be a gun owner, and
right.
don't date gun owners. But you don't need a firearm. You don't want a firearm. They take great pains to say, listen, we're not anti-gun. But just know that if you become a gun owner, Barca, you're opening yourself up to becoming the victim of a violent crime. You are, you know, umpteen times more likely to have that gun used against you than you are to be able to defend yourself with it.
And I think that's what we are fighting. I think that they're trying to see gun ownership as a male prerogative, and you know that you don't date a gun owner, whereas I'm just saying, forget it. Don't date a gun owner. Be the gun owner. So, you know, I think I'm a step ahead of them. I get it. And when I first started talking to even some of my friends who support gun ownership, they were like, why are you going to touch on something so controversial? Why don't you start with something else? And, you know, it's the opposite. I've had so much support. I work with women who are impoverished, who are abuse victims. I've worked with different sectors of the population down here, because in South Florida it's a very mixed bag of people. There's a lot of immigrants. We have Hispanics. We have immigrants from all backgrounds, and you'll be surprised how much support I've gotten. So you know the support is out there.
That's fantastic.
I think that we need to reach out to women more. I think we need to make this a women's issue.
you know, I use a hashtag on Twitter quite a bit. Self-defense is a human right. Because I don't want it to be a woman's issue any more than I want it to be a man's issue. I really do believe that self-defense, our right to keep and bear arms is enshrined in our Constitution. It wasn't granted by the people who wrote the Constitution. It wasn't granted by the people who ratified the Bill of Rights. This enshrined a pre-existing right. I do believe that we have a human right of self-defense. And you've got a quote at your website, herrights.org, from Susan B. Anthony. A woman must not depend on the protection of man, but must be taught to protect herself. And it seems to me that what you're talking about, Abarca, is really a message of empowerment. You are not victim blaming. You are not telling people who are the victims of crime that, you brought this on yourself because you didn't have a gun. But you want people, men and women of all ages, to be able to protect themselves, to be able to defend themselves, and to think about these things.
And you're absolutely right. I don't, you know, for the longest time, and I've lived here in this country, I'm an immigrant, I lived here in this country for 27 years now, and for the first, let's say, 25 years, I just looked at myself as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized that, you know, there's a lot of sort of, comments on, well, you know, the GOP is nothing but white men and this and that. And the only person that can change that is somebody like me.
Yes,
So I think that me being a spokesperson for firearms has an impact and a reach to a population that's usually underserved. And I'm not saying that it's an exclusive right. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that women are the only people, but I think that women are underserved in the firearms community. I think that having a women's only class, and this is why there are 900 people who signed up for it. I think a woman might be intimidated walking into a class that has 19 men and only one woman taking a class. So.
No, I could definitely see that. And, we've talked with a lot of female firearms instructors over the years from coast to coast who talk about that. When you are sort of breaking out of your comfort zone, it helps to have, again, a little bit of comfort, right? Okay, well, at least I'm not the only new person here. I'm not the only person who's never shot a gun before. I can tell you, by the way, Barca, that, guys feel that way too, if they are very new to this. And there are a lot of guys who are becoming gun owners who didn't grow up in a gun owning family, who are also having that conversation. So I think, I think that, what you're saying certainly holds true. For women who are becoming interested, I think across the industry, hopefully this is something that the industry recognizes, that we have a lot of new people who are becoming interested in exercising their rights. And there is that. I think the commonality there is making sure that those people are comfortable, that they're not dismissed, or that they don't feel like they are going into something where they're the only person who has no idea what they're doing with a firearm and they're there to learn.
Absolutely. And I also think that if a woman knows how to shoot, there's, it's more likely that the entire family will go shooting. So, there's also that.
Yes, I would actually, as someone who's been married for 18 years, I think that, that definitely applies, right? What's the phrase? If mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy, right? So if mama likes to go to the range,
so
the
I'm
whole family probably likes to go to the range.
Say that, I have some special rights. I think that as human beings, we all have the right to bear arms. And I think that there's an underserved population there. So.
Well, I think it is fantastic what you're doing. Do you have any plans to try to offer these courses more frequently? Can we help out in order to help?
We're actually looking for the classes we've been offering has been in Palm Beach, and we're kind of in negotiation. We're trying to find places that are willing to let us hold our classes in Broward County, as well as new locations in Palm Beach. So, if you know anybody, if somebody wants to reach out to me, we're open, and we want to do more trainings, and we want to accommodate all 900 women who wanted to do this class.
Well, listen, we'd love to help you out and love to talk to you again in the future, Barca. Thank you again for what you do, and it is absolutely fantastic to get a chance to talk with you today.
Well, thank you for having me. This has been great.
Yeah, my pleasure. We'll talk again very soon, I promise. Barca Herman, join us. The website, again, is herrights.org. where you can find out more information about Barca and what she's doing there, not only with the Second Amendment, but also school choice, free market education. And again, 20 spots available, 900 people responded, just on Facebook. That doesn't count the phone calls. That doesn't count the email saying, yeah, I'd like to attend this class. 900 Facebook responses. Huh. I'm telling you, I don't think it's a fad. I don't think this is a statistical blip. I think that, you know, again, a lot has been made of the spike in NICS checks or concealed carry applications since the attack in San Bernardino. But if you look at the graphs, if you look at the statistics over time, the rise in right to carry has been occurring for a number of years. This may have accelerated the trend, but the trend has been taking place for quite some time. And I don't think that it's going to stop anytime soon, quite frankly. All right, when we return here on NRA News, Cam and Company, Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation has a new piece out. It says the Obama administration wants to make sure that non-citizens are voting in the upcoming election in November. We'll talk with Hans about this right after a quick timeout, so stick around. There is much more. NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, on the way.
With the NSSF Project Child Safe. Bill, welcome to NRA News.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Hey, thanks for being here. And what a great program, the Project Child Safe program. I absolutely love it. Tell folks, what is it?
Yeah, for those who aren't familiar with it, this is the firearms industry's safety program. It was launched in 1999 as Project Home Safe initially, and then it evolved into Project Child Safe. And it really operates along two central fronts. One is it's all about firearm safety education, primarily focusing on responsible storage of firearms when they're not in use. And then hand-in-hand with that, the other facet of this, and kind of the centerpiece of the program, is we give away free gun locks to police departments all across the country to hand out in their communities. And so far, we've given away 37 million of those locks.
37 million.
Yeah, it's been a phenomenally successful program, and it is something that the firearms community can be very proud of.
Wow, that's amazing. So tell, how did this program get started and why?
Well, primarily it got started because it was an opportunity for the industry to step up and say, you know, we don't want to see firearms accidents happen. There's, you know, even today, unfortunately, too many stories of children finding loaded guns in the home and an accident resulting from that. And so this industry stepped up. There's a brainstorm of somebody at NSSF to come up with this program to basically let's teach people what they need to know about proper firearm safety and expel some of the myths, like, you know, a hidden gun is not a safe gun, for example. And at the same time, let's take away some of the barriers to safe storage by making these locks available for free.
And Bill, you're with the National Shooting Sports Foundation. People don't know that the NSSF is the industry, the shooting industries association.
That's a trade association.
Yeah, trade association.
Industry, huh?
So the you have done this, you know, working in concert with the, you know, all the different gun manufacturers, but NSSF has really taken a leadership role as this program has grown. Tell us, over the years, how has it grown and changed?
Sure. Well, we were very, very big program in the 2000s. We were getting a lot of federal funding through the Department of Justice to do the program, and that's where we had a lot of our biggest successes and where we, you know, we're giving away most of the locks. Then in 2008, the grant terms expired and they weren't renewed, and so the NSSF on its own continued to fund the program for the next several years. And I am happy to say that for 2016, some of that federal funding has now been renewed.
Oh, good.
To the tune of about $2 million, which, you know, as we say, every $2 puts another lock in someone's hands. And so that will provide a lot of money for both making more locks available in communities as well as getting more educational resources out there.
And Bill, one of the things we all talk about is, as you mentioned, is safety is paramount. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you're at home, you're on the range, that's like, you know, the first order of business when it comes to, you know, the firearm, you know, using a firearm, whether you're hunting or shooting or at the range or whatever. So in some of the time we left, you know, what are some of the most egregious kind of safety violations you guys are aware of?
Well, you know, it's the funny thing. It's like when you look at the rules of firearm safety, number one, they're not rocket science. And number two, they really haven't changed since the firearm was invented. It's pointed in a safe direction, you know, keep it stored safely, things like that. And my personal opinion is I think that's why we have some of the accidents we do, is because the rules have been out there so long and they're so simple that we get a little bit complacent.
Yeah, and maybe take them for granted, right?
Exactly.
Which, when it comes to a firearm, you never want to take it for granted. So
that's right.
It's Bill Romanelli. It's the NSSF Projects Child Safe. I love it. Bill, how can people get more information about Projects Child Safe, about the National Shooting Sports Foundation? What do they need to do?
Sure. The easiest thing, of course, is going to go onto our website, which is www.projectchildsafe.org. We really would love people to, as individuals, sign up as supporters of the program. Also for organizations out there, retailers, shooting ranges, people in the conservation community. You know, we want as much help as we can get getting this word out. We don't rely on ourselves alone. We want to basically have essentially a team of messengers out there helping us get this message out there to the firearms-only community. And if I may, you know, it's something that I've noticed is that the firearms-owning community, the firearm community as a whole, you know, they're a very proud community. You know, they do not like being villainized or demonized.
Right.
And, you know, they in fact focus on ethical hunting. They focus on responsible gun ownership. They're looking for something to be for and something that they can rally around. And this is a program that they can do that with.
That's awesome. All right, Bill, we got about 20, 30 seconds left. Once again, how can we get more information about Project Child Safe?
Sure. Go to www.projectchildsafe.org. If you're looking for safety resources, just click on our safety tab. Cool. Our entire library of safety resources is available there.
Beautiful. Bill Romanelli, the NSSF Project Child Safe, thanks for what you do. Thanks for the National Shooting Sports Foundation for what they do. And thanks for being on NRA News.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming to you today from Farmville, Virginia. Next week, we'll be up in the D.C. area for the Conservative Political Action Conference. Might even see Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation there. Hans, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing okay, and I hope to see you there.
Absolutely. You've got a piece at the National Review right now on the Obama administration wanting to make sure non-citizens vote in the upcoming election. This is the headline here. Now, that's a heck of a charge, Hans. What's going on here? What's the Obama administration doing?
Well, a couple of states, Kansas, Arizona, Georgia, Alabama. Look, they've had problems finding people who aren't U.S. citizens registering and voting in their states. So they've passed laws that say that when you register to vote, you have to provide proof of citizenship. And so they've made it pretty easy for you to meet that requirement. So they went to the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. That's this federal agency that's in charge of the federal voter registration form. And they said, look, will you change the instructions on your website for people who want to use that form to register to vote, and put into the instructions that if you're a resident of one of our states, in addition to using that form to register, you're going to have to provide proof of citizenship. The agency said, okay, we will do that. This is about 3 weeks ago, and immediately the NAACP, the League of Women Voters, and some other, frankly, left-wing advocacy groups all sued and said, no, you cannot do that. You cannot allow the states to require proof of citizenship. The U.S. Justice Department is the agency charged with defending the EAC if it gets sued, just like it's supposed to defend all federal agencies when they get sued.
Mm-hmm.
But in a hearing yesterday on Monday in federal court in Washington, the League of Women Voters, they'd asked for a restraining order to prevent the agency from doing this. The Justice Department came into the case, and instead of defending the EAC, they came in and tried to roll over and say, actually, we're not going to defend the agency and what it's done. We want to agree to put in a restraining order. We basically want to give the plaintiffs everything they've asked for. So the federal government is in there saying that the state should not be allowed to verify the citizenship of people who are registering to vote.
Wow, shouldn't be allowed to.
No, should not be allowed to. That's what they said. The hearing was one of the most – look, I've been a lawyer for a long time. I've been to a lot of federal hearings, especially when I worked for the Justice Department. This was one of the most extraordinary hearings I've ever seen because the judge, when he came in, he was shocked at the behavior of the Justice Department. He said he had never in his entire career seen the Justice Department come in and basically try to throw a case, try to lose a case the way they did yesterday. He gave the Justice Department lawyers a dressing down in court and gave them a very tough time about what they were doing in the case. I frankly think they were acting unethically, but I'm sure they were doing exactly what their political masters,
right,
you know, Obama appointees, were telling them to do.
Well, I'm sure that you're right. What kind of impact is this likely to have? I mean, when you've got the federal government, in essence, saying, we're not going to go along with our agency. We're not going to defend this. We find their position indefensible. I mean, it's almost like you end up having a hostile witness for the, you know, defense at a trial. All of a sudden, your defendant is not on your side, but now your defendant is working for the other side.
Right. Well, no, you're exactly right. And to their astonishment, and by their I mean the folks who were the organization that filed the suit and the Justice Department, the judge came in saying, I'm not about to let the Justice Department immediately consent to a restraining order. In fact, I'm going to allow the Secretary of State of Kansas, Chris Kobach, who had asked to intervene in the lawsuit so that he could defend what this federal agency had done, I'm going to let him intervene, and I'm going to let him argue on behalf of the EAC. So Chris Kobach stood up and basically did what the Justice Department should have done and defended the case. We're supposed to find out today from the judge whether or not he's going to issue a restraining order. But like I said, he was pretty severe on the Justice Department and what they were doing in this case. So I'm actually hopeful that he's going to refuse to prevent the states from verifying citizenship.
If that does happen, who would then be appealing this? I guess it would be the private parties, these groups who initiated the suit. They would be appealing this decision?
Yeah, they will be, and I'm sure the Justice Department will be basically helping them with the appeal. I mean, look, you can't call this anything less than a conspiracy, really, between the Justice Department and these plaintiffs groups to get around the law and the Constitution and what is the right thing to do here. And it's clearly purely for political reasons because they know, look, there's been some demographic studies that have done probably 70-80% of people who aren't citizens vote for the Democratic Party. And that's why they want non-citizens registering and voting, even though it's a felony under federal law.
And this would they're seeking to get this restraining order for the elections this year, correct?
That's exactly right. There are primaries coming up in the various states that have passed this law, and that's why they were in court yesterday, because they wanted an order immediately stopping this federal agency from doing this and thus preventing the states from checking citizenship.
Wow. Unbelievable. Listen, Hans, I appreciate you coming on the program. Hopefully when we see you next week at CPAC, we can get an update from you on this and other cases.
Yeah, hopefully it'll be good news.
Hopefully. I appreciate you coming on the program today. It's always good talking with you, sir.
Sure, anytime. Bye-bye.
Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation with us here on NRA News, Cam & Company. And we will keep our eyes on that case, maybe even reach out to try to talk with Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State there in Kansas, at some point. Now, coming up top of the hour, we have the Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcore Defense, also the Deal of the Day, our Good Guy of the Day, Chris Ching, good guy himself, from the Coalition for More Civil Liberties, formed in California to take on Gavin Newsom's anti-gun referendum. Plus, Julie Gunlock from the Independent Women's Forum will join us on the program this afternoon as well. We'll get a nanny state update from Julie Gunlock. Speaking of the nanny state, keeping my eyes on stories and columns talking about Michael Bloomberg and the potential for a Bloomberg run. The Daily Beast has an article today from Jonathan Alter. Here's how, he says, a Bloomberg presidency can happen. I love this way this starts by Jonathan Alter. I hear from sources close to former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg that he will almost certainly run for president as an independent if Republicans nominate Donald Trump and Democrats nominate Bernie Sanders. Like, that's his inside scoop. That's been reported for weeks now. But there's your hot new lead from Jonathan Alter. With Hillary Clinton's victory in the Nevada caucuses, Alter writes, the latter is increasingly unlikely but still plausible, as is Bloomberg's election. So I'm not predicting the following will occur, but it could. So, again, start with the assumption that it's Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. A Hillary Clinton campaign makes it less likely that Bloomberg gets in, more likely that Bloomberg spends scads of money trying to elect Hillary Clinton and other anti-gun candidates. But Alter writes in this sort of hypothetical, here's how Bloomberg wins. Over time, Bernie Sanders' righteous anger and indisputable authenticity proved a better match for the mood of Democrats than Hillary's. Then the Hillary camp's claims about electability. Plus, he kept raising millions online from small donors while Hillary's big donors were tapped out. While it looked in March as if Hillary was romping with superdelegates, in truth, most stayed uncommitted until their states voted, at which point scores felt obliged to hold their noses and back Sanders. So, all right, so South Carolina, the March 1st primaries, Sanders outperforms Clinton, manages to deny her a bunch of superdelegates. In mid-March, Alter writes, as Bloomberg had to decide whether to file for ballot positions in all 50 states, Hillary's campaign rocked by fresh news on the fallout from her handling of highly classified emails. FBI leaks showed that a pair of career prosecutors had recommended an indictment. Attorney General Loretta Lynch, recognizing that other senior officials over the years had been similarly careless in emails, squelched a criminal prosecution, but in order to maintain its integrity, the Obama DOJ issued a stinging interim report that led Sanders reopen an issue he had closed in 2015. I like, by the way, how in Jonathan Alter's hypothetical imagining of what will happen, you've got career prosecutors who say Hillary should be indicted, but you've got an attorney general of this administration who says, no, that's not going to happen. But instead, there's a stinging interim report issued. I think if that happens, Jonathan Alter's probably going to be needing to write some more columns about the implosion of the Obama administration, not just the Hillary Clinton campaign. Alter says, as he announced his candidacy, Bloomberg began spending some of the $1 billion he had promised in January of 2016 to devote to a race. He could afford it. Revised estimates of his net worth put his fortune at $40 billion, which trumped Trump's pile, and neutralized the Donald's claim, central to his popularity, to being the only candidate who couldn't be bought. Many of Trump's supporters mistakenly believed their man was self-made when they learned through Bloomberg ads that Bloomberg had pulled himself up by his bootstraps while Trump inherited his fortune and stiffed working people during his three bankruptcies. It hurt Trump. A February Wall Street Journal, NBC News poll that showed Sanders leading Trump 43-33% with 16% for Bloomberg. But after Bloomberg began flooding the airwaves across the country while Sanders and Trump husbanded their resources for the fall, the numbers changed. The huge ad buys gave him a lead by summer, just as billionaire Ross Perot led in mid-1992 polls over both Governor Bill Clinton and President George Bush. Unlike Perot, Alter writes, Bloomberg wouldn't blow it with crazy stunts. Oh, no. I'm sure he's got the money for focus groups and consultants and all sorts of campaign managers who would tell him to play it safe and don't let any of these groups out there, like Every Town for Gun Safety and Moms Demand Action and Celebrities for Gun Control or whatever that group's called. Do they have a name? I'm not sure. Funny or Die. Make sure that none of them actually say anything about your candidacy for like the next 6 months or so. I'm sure that they'll have that message discipline. Just out of curiosity, by the way, Alter says Bloomberg spends a ton of money and automatically leads in the polls. D- you kind of wonder, like, does Jonathan Alter know what has happened? You know, Bloomberg, when he ran for a third term as mayor, had to change the city charter, spent more money than anybody had ever spent on a mayoral campaign. I think it was like $183 a vote. He got 51% of the vote. Since then, when Bloomberg has tried to compete, tried to get his gun control candidates in office, spent more than $2 million. Now, again, I realize that's chump change for Bloomberg, but it's a lot of money to spend on a couple of state senate races in New Jersey. Wasn't able to flip the dial. As a matter of fact, an interesting dynamic has sort of been noted, that the more money Bloomberg spends, the more the opposition to his position grows, because the more people are aware of his position and what he's trying to do. So it cuts both ways. You're saturating the airwaves with ads to try to get your message out. But the more people start paying attention to you, then the more people start paying attention to you and what you've said and what you've done and the positions that you've advocated in the past. Anyway, Alter goes on, says the conventions for both parties, PR disasters, blah, 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 blah. And eventually he magically ekes out a win to become president. Now, one of the things that Alter doesn't mention in his hypothetical adventure of Michael Bloomberg is a poll. This is in today's New York Post. Perhaps Alter was unaware of it. Majority of New Yorkers don't want Michael Bloomberg to be president. New Yorkers. Yeah. Not everybody lives in New York, you know, lives in New York City. And as it turns out, most people who live in the state of New York don't want Bloomberg as their president. Didn't want him as their governor. They're happy to have him in New York City as their mayor. Would have been happier maybe if he was just a private citizen. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Speaking with Chris Brackett of Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil, presented by Mossy Oak, and that is on Outdoor Channel and also Arrow Affliction on Sportsman Channel. Chris, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing amazing.
Well, we got a lot to talk about, so let's get started. First, tell folks, what is Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil? What's that all about?
So Fear No Evil is a deeper, darker look at why any crazy person would sit in a tree from dusk till dark and do all the things that we do as hunters. And, you know, sometimes you find yourself just, why am I doing this? I'm sitting here and I'm freezing to death. But it's a, you know, deep, dark look at big game hunting, and it takes you on a roller coaster of emotions. Most people say, you know, our show is different than others. Ours really, we try to capture a 30-minute movie. So each one is different than the other one. And you know, some of them may be funny. Some of them may make you cry. Other ones, you know, takes you on a roller coaster. And it, you know, the industry is a change in that way. And we wanted to really make a one where your wife will sit down and watch, you know, and she doesn't watch normal hunting shows.
And I think that's great, Chris, because it's good to get inside the mind of a hunter, because most people who don't hunt look at them going, why in the world would you want to do that?
Yeah, you have different classifications of different outdoor television, right? You have entertainment, you have education, and then you have this kind of, you know, the kind of the old standard of, okay, here comes a deer, cutaways, this and that. And, and everybody likes one for a different. And for years, for the last 10 years, we just decided to make it completely organic in its own art.
So tell me, and I know we could probably talk about this all afternoon.
Right, I love it. Yeah.
What is it? Where did you get that passion? What can you tell people in 30 to 40 seconds here why you do what you do? Why is it so, to the non-hunter, so great?
For me, it's absolutely, it is in my blood, number one. I can't not go after something. Number two is that, you know, God kind of put it on me to inspire and educate through entertainment, and that's my mule. That's my entertainment.
That was excellent. So that's Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil, presented by Mossy Oak. That's on Outdoor Channel. Now let's shift gears with Chris. Let's talk about Arrow Affliction on Sportsman Channel. What is that all about?
So Arrow Affliction is the almost opposite of Fear No Evil. Fear No Evil is this dark. It's almost like, you know, you love chocolate ice cream, you love vanilla ice cream. Well, it's kind of the lighter side of bow hunting. Fun with arrows, shoot everything, hunt the way you and me got a BB gun and did everything that we could think of as 10, 12-year-olds, and now we're grown men doing the same thing with arrows. hunting bullfrogs, ducks, doves, geese, pheasants out of the air, just shooting and you know, and really pushing yourself.
So is it tough for you, Chris? I mean, that's a lot of plates to spin, a lot of balls to juggle to have those two TV shows in production. Does it get tough?
Yeah, and we went a different route. You know, I was born and raised in the Midwest, and I'd had nothing, and I created it from nothing. So it truly is an American dream being able to do this. But at the same time, what everybody really has to understand is that I don't have any kids. I don't even have a mortgage on a house. I rent a house. I give everything to my art to inspire and educate all the viewers. And so for us to do it, we're on the road, you know, most of the year. I started in September 1. I just ended 5 days ago killing a giant Boone and Crockett deer in Ohio. And I've devoted my entire life for everybody else to enjoy the adventures that we go on.
Your passion is total. It's all out.
it's full throttle, man.
It's Chris Brackett's Fear No Evil, presented by Mossy Oak on Outdoor Channel and Arrow Affliction on Sportsman Channel. Chris, how can people get more information about Chris Brackett and about your great shows?
Well, the best way is you can go to fearnoevil.com, the website.
Thank you so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back. Hour 3 of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcore Defense. Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, coming up in this segment. Also, Chris Cheng from the Coalition for More Civil Liberties out in California. Our friend Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum joining us on the program later on in the hour as well. I mentioned as we were heading into the break, this new survey of New Yorkers, New York Post writes about it. It's a New York One poll, and it actually is of New York City residents. So this is not of New York State voters. This is New York City voters. Nearly 60% of those surveyed said they don't want to see Bloomberg launch a third-party run. Only about 33% said they would prefer Bloomberg be on the ballot. 7% said they were unsure. So if you've got a third of the city that you were mayor of for three terms, a third of the voters there saying, yeah, run, Mike, run. That's your Bloomberg boomlet, I suppose, because it really hasn't happened anywhere else around the country. All right, on to the hero of the day, sponsored by Adcore Defense. This from KARE in the Twin Cities, Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. KARE Channel 11 reporting, Brooklyn Park police say it appears that a man who was fatally shot Monday night was attempting to rob somebody who was legally carrying a firearm. Assistant Chief Mark Brule says the preliminary investigation into the shooting indicates that the man who was killed targeted an individual who had a valid permit to carry a handgun as his victim. Witnesses say there was an exchange of gunfire and the alleged robber was killed. Investigators recovered both weapons from the scene. They are analyzing as part of the ongoing investigation. The man who was reportedly targeted by the robber and fired the fatal shot has not been arrested, according to KARE. Police say that they are seeking no additional suspects in the incident. We will continue following the story. KARE reporting this just a couple of hours ago, so hopefully we'll be able to get more information for you on tomorrow's NRA News, Cam and Company. But our hero of the day, defending himself from a robber there in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. Our deal of the day from WINK, yes, Wink. And the website winknews.com. Story out of Texas, Fort Myers, Florida. Four individuals arrested in a home burglary in Lee County over the weekend. 37-year-old Robert Aponte, 31-year-old Michael Neff, 22-year-old Stephanie Horton, 29-year-old Kimberly Sandy, facing charges of grand theft, burglary, and the fraudulent use of a credit card. Both Robert Aponte and Michael Zeff are being held without bond. WINK says all four individuals have lengthy criminal histories. The 37-year-old suspect, Robert Aponte, has been arrested 17 times before on charges of burglary, grand theft, dealing in stolen property, and forgery. 31-year-old Michael Zeff is a convicted felon who has been booked 12 times in the Lee County Jail in Florida, just one county, for a string of burglaries. Stephanie Horton, age 22, has already been locked up on 8 different occasions dealing with drugs and theft-related charges. And 29-year-old Kimberly Sandy has 5 priors for prostitution, drugs, and battery. WINK quotes Trish Root, who is the Crime Stoppers coordinator there in Lee County. She said repeat criminals, like the 4 who were arrested this morning, are constantly looking for crimes of opportunity. By taking small steps like making sure doors and windows are secure, residents can easily protect themselves from being a thief's next target. Well, sure, absolutely. Take the steps. But that might not stop a devoted and committed thief from still trying to get entry to your home. The Crime Stoppers coordinator, Trish Root, didn't get into why we have repeat criminals like Robert DePonte, Michael Zeff, Stephanie Horton, Kimberly Sandy. How someone can reach the ripe old age of 31 and have more than a dozen arrests to their name, or reach the age of 37 with 17 different arrests, or a 22-year-old who's got to 8 arrests. No, because that's just part of the system, apparently. The revolving door of justice. So the Crime Stoppers, they're not talking about how we stop crime by dealing with career criminals, right? It's just, here's how you deal with career criminals, because the system doesn't. So you lock your doors, you make sure your windows are secure, so that the career criminals who will inevitably get released again can't gain easy entry into your home. Robert DePonte, Michael Zeff, Stephanie Horton, Kimberly Sandy, our deals of the day. And our good guy of the day from Fontana, California. The Press Enterprise newspaper reporting back on February 18th, a Fontana police officer, Jorge Rodriguez, responded to a report of a house fire. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning. He got there. House was fully engulfed in flames. And Officer Rodriguez heard a sound coming from the back of the home, heard a whimpering sound. He went to the back and he saw a dog there in the house, sitting behind a security screen door. Little dog's name is Diamond. And Officer Rodriguez, despite the fact that the house was, again, did I mention fully engulfed in flames, got the door open. And little Diamond scampered away into the yard. Press Enterprise says, despite a lot of smoke inhalation, the dog is in good condition. The owner of the dog in the home, not at home at the time. The fire put out by San Bernardino County firefighters and Officer Jorge Rodriguez, protecting and serving the community, including the four-legged members of the community. So a tip of the cap to Officer Jorge Rodriguez, one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, still to come on the program, talking about what's going on in California with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom's anti-gun efforts. I can tell you that one of California's neighbors seems to be moving in the opposite direction. This is good news. Senate Bill 1266 passing the state Senate in Arizona on Thursday with a vote of 18 to 11. This is a firearms preemption measure in the state of Arizona. Provides a mechanism to declare unlawful regulations null and void when they conflict with state law. It also provides penalties for knowing and willful violations by localities. So when a town or a city decides to heck with state law, we don't really care what state law says. We're going to do our own thing. We're going to pass our own anti-gun ordinances. Now, not only can you sue to get these ordinances off the books, but if the city or town was aware that what they were doing was in conflict with state law, there would actually be a financial penalty to pay. There wouldn't be the sort of get-out-of-jail-free card for politicians who want to flout state law. So, Senate Bill 1266 heading over to the House of Representatives in the state of Iowa. Meanwhile, in the state Senate, still in the state Senate, you got Senate Bill 1257, which makes changes to existing law, expands the list of places where law-abiding gun owners can exercise their right to carry, to include some additional public areas where certain security measures are not in place. This is, again, waiting for a vote over there on the Senate side in Arizona. There were two bills passing out of the state House of Representatives that are now heading over to the Senate side in Arizona as well. House Bill 2224 would prohibit the state in any political subdivision from levying a fee or a tax or an assessment or other financial encumbrance on the transfer of a firearm between two private parties who are not prohibited under state or federal law. And then there's House Bill 2446, which revises Arizona's current definition of a prohibited weapon to exclude all firearms or devices that are legally possessed in compliance with the National Firearms Act. So this is more of a technical correction. It, again, is passed out of the House, heading over to the state Senate there in Arizona. We'll keep our eyes on all of these measures. But if you are a Arizona gun owner, make sure that your state senator and your state representative have heard from you. I mentioned as well, and if you listened to yesterday's program, we told you what happened in West Virginia with permitless carry passing out of the state Senate. There is apparently a group of delegates in the House of Representatives in West Virginia really doesn't want this legislation to become law. So they know that the governor says he's going to veto the measure. In West Virginia, a simple majority is enough to override a governor's veto. So these lawmakers are trying to send this bill not to the House floor for a final concurrence vote, which would then send the bill to Governor Tomlin's desk, where he could veto it, and the legislature could override the veto. Instead, despite passing handily in the House and handily in the state Senate in West Virginia, some lawmakers actually want to send this bill to a conference committee where the bill would likely die. It would just sort of fade away. It would go to this committee. They'd never take action. They'd never revise it. They'd never put it out. If they did change the law in any way, shape, or form, or the bill in any way, shape, or form, you'd have to have more votes in the Senate, more votes in the House, tie it up. Let's keep this at worst-case scenario. We can't defeat the bill legislatively. Let's keep it tied up until the session's over so the governor can veto it again and the legislature can't come back and override the governor's veto. That's what they're trying to do. So if you are a West Virginia gun owner, make sure that both your state senator and your state representative, because, again, this is a conference committee between the Senate and the House, make sure both of your representatives have heard from you on this issue. The bill is House Bill 4145. It is sponsored by Representative Sarah Blair. We had the opportunity to speak with Representative Blair on the program not long ago. Youngest delegate to a state legislature in America. She's 19. She is a gun owner. And under the terms of this provision, as she admits, she's got a dog in this fight. Because under the terms of this bill, not only does this bill allow for permitless carry for those over the age of 21, but it also allows for law-abiding, trained individuals who are 18 to 21 to obtain a concealed carry license, which they are unable to do in West Virginia right now. Including the state representative, who is old enough to vote, old enough to serve the military, old enough to serve her country in office, but is not old enough under law right now to actually carry that firearm that she is legally allowed to own. So again, it's House Bill 4145, permitless carry legislation. some concealed carry reform measures in there. And again, lawmakers in West Virginia trying to do what they can't do via a vote, trying to move this permitless carry over to a conference committee. And I'm trying to look to see here what the process is of moving a bill to a conference committee, like what the vote actually has to be. But I will probably have to look that up in greater detail during a break here. But, you know, the easiest thing to do would be to make sure that every lawmaker in the state has heard from a number of their constituents. The phone lines are melting down. The emails are causing the server to overheat. And all of these voices are speaking out in support of permitless carry. That would be the ideal situation, because that would make it a little bit easier for these lawmakers. But we will keep our eyes on what's going on there, and hopefully, maybe even later in the week, talk with Representative Blair about the latest there in West Virginia, what the prospects are like to get that bill back to the House floor for one final vote. Again, after a quick timeout, then we're going to talk about anti-gun efforts, not in West Virginia, but all the way across the country in California, where it seems like it's a thing, right? You'd think they'd have all of the anti-gun laws that they could dream up already on the books. But no. Nope. They keep coming up with new ways to restrict the legal ownership of firearms. They keep coming up with new proposals that would target the law-abiding gun owners in the state of California instead of focusing on the violent criminals, because that's what the anti-gun lawmakers are going to do, right? But there is a coalition, and a broad-based coalition, that is standing up and speaking out and pushing back against these anti-gun initiatives. We'll talk with Chris Ching from the Coalition for More Civil Liberties right after this quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam and Company.
Speaking with Bobby Wiggins with Warrior Outdoors. Welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
Well, right here on your card, sir, it says Healing for Heroes. That's Tell great. Us, what are you all about? What do you do?
Warrior Outdoors is a nonprofit organization. We are geared towards helping veterans, particularly with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. We take vets and first responders to on outdoor activities, hunting, fishing, monster truck shows, to paintball, I mean, just anything outdoors to help prevent withdrawal.
How'd you get this started?
I'm actually a service-connected disabled vet myself. I'll go ahead and tell you, my rating with the VA is 70%. When I was medically discharged from the Marine Corps, I did a lot of my own therapy. I signed an inch-thick book of papers saying I couldn't talk about this, couldn't see, do anything.
Right.
So I went out to a tree stand with a hunting rifle, and that's where I spent the majority of my time doing my own rehab. So it was like a light switch that clicked and said, I cannot be the only person like this. So I started this organization and built a great team to help me out, and that's now I'm sitting here with you.
That's so awesome. It's great, Bobby, to see you, when people do this. And out of necessity, what's born this kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. out of necessity was born Warrior Outdoors, because this is what you had to do for yourself, and now you're doing it for others.
That's correct. Not saying that any other organization out there is bad, because they're all good. It's just we can't have enough organizations like this helping veterans.
Absolutely.
We have 22 veterans a day right now. The numbers from the DOD, it's 22 veterans a day committing suicide.
Oh.
One is too many.
How do we get more information about Warrior Outdoors?
You can visit the website, warrioroutdoors.org.
Bobby, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you.
Talk with a friend, Benny Spies, again from Gunner with Benny Spies. Hopefully the audience has watched the program. If not,
if you have it, you should.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it really is a fun show. And that's what I like about it, is that it's not your
It's not, you know, 2 minutes in.
No, we do a lot.
We've got to, you know, when's the dead deer coming? As you say, it really is personality driven.
Yep.
You are, you're quite the personality.
There's a lot of moving parts. We do a lot of different things. We drive around that old Winnebago, the Toaster 73, or the old Chevelle 65. It's a secret weapon. You know, we got the new boat, the Aluma Craft, the Willie Nelson. You know, there's a lot of moving parts, and we have a lot of fun.
Why is the boat called the Willie Nelson?
Because my old man, when I was a kid, would take me fishing or whatever, wherever we were going hunting or fishing, he had one tape and it was stuck into the cassette tape in the pickup, and it was always On the Road Again. It's the only song that I ever, my first favorite song, so I dedicated the boat to Willie Nelson.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's the truth.
Does
story.
The Chevelle have a name?
The Chevelle's a secret weapon, yeah.
It's just the secret weapon.
That's not running right now. Nothing of mine runs.
No?
No, the boat does, but nothing of mine runs.
Do you actually, like, tow the toaster?
Yeah, it's
around it, from
the toaster would be better off on fire.
But it's iconic.
It is iconic.
You'll never be able to get rid of that thing.
I hope I don't have to. So I hope I can keep doing this. And where I go, the toaster goes.
Right.
That's the plan.
So you're saying that you don't want to show up here 1 year and be like, instead of the toaster, you've got the bread oven, which is like the, you know, the 80-foot long concert tour bus.
Well, that means we've upgraded a little bit.
Yeah.
But I still want it to be in the 70s. You know, we need the shag carpet. You know, we need it. Smelling like the 70s. There's more mice living in that thing right now. That I have a trap line actually set up in there, and I put a big jar of peanut butter at the end of it. I say, if you guys can make it through that, Godspeed.
Welcome back. NRA News, Cam and Company. Julie Dunlock of the Independent Women's Forum coming up with a Nanny State update a little bit later on in the hour. Right now, I want to welcome from the Coalition for More Civil Liberties out in California, our friend Chris Chang. Chris, how you doing, sir?
Hey, good afternoon, Cam. Doing really great over here in California.
Excellent. It's good to talk with you again. And it is great news as a gun owner in Virginia who pays close attention to what's going on in California. It is great to hear that there is this group now, the Coalition for More Civil Liberties. LA Times wrote about it a couple of days ago, quoted you. And this is a group that has been formed in response to Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom's anti-gun referendum that he wants to run on the ballot this November, right?
Exactly. So where we're at in the process is Lieutenant Governor Newsom has put the proposal out in the public space, and they're currently requiring they need to collect signatures to get the initiative on the ballot for the November election. And so we're trying to, you know, stop the ballot initiative from even getting that far. So we're really talking about we have until June to really prevent signatures and stop, you know, convince people that signing the initiative to get on the ballot is a bad idea. And what we really want to do with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties is to create a really broad umbrella. Right. So this is not just a gun issue. So this is a civil liberties issue. We want to, you know, include other groups who understand the dangers of government overreach. And, you know, even worse, that, you know, this Newsom proposal really won't have any impact on improving public safety. The core of the proposal is requiring a license to purchase ammunition, and to also ban standard capacity magazines, which are, you know, both two really terrible ideas that really won't move the needle on public safety. So we want to create this broad coalition and position that says, hey, this is a civil liberty, the right for us to protect ourselves, but also to push back on government overreach.
Absolutely. And, you know, so let's talk about some of these measures here. First of all, we've got the magazine ban, right?
Correct.
This would, and Chris, you know, right now in California, you can't buy a new magazine over 10 rounds, but people who've had these magazines, they are allowed under California law to continue to possess them. But that would not be the case under Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom's proposal, right? You would be required to sell your magazines to, the LA Times says you'd be required to sell them to a licensed firearms dealer. But why would a licensed firearms dealer want something that they cannot sell? So then your options would be to either take them out of state or turn them over to police. But either way, you would not be allowed to legally own something that currently you are now allowed to legally own.
That's correct. And the fourth option there is also to just destroy them. And so, you know, any of those options for, you know, any California residents that currently own a standard capacity magazine that's, you know, that holds more than 10 rounds, all of those options are terrible options, right? You've been not only invested your time and money into purchasing a valuable product, but to have the government come in and basically either force you to hand them over or to force you to destroy, you know, your private property is really untenable for many California residents, you know, myself included.
Now, the other measure that is included here is a bill that would or a referendum measure that would require background checks for ammunition purchases. Now, this is something, Chris, that was part of the SAFE Act when it was passed in New York State back in 2013. Here we are 3 years later. The state of New York hasn't figured out a way to actually implement this proposal without it costing, you know, an extra $25 or so every time you want to go purchase a box of ammunition or two. And yet this, despite, you know, the real life problems that a state has had in trying to implement this anti-gun fantasy, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom wants to impose this same burden on every gun owner in the state of California.
So it's interesting that you bring up the New York example because, you know, I also have not seen any forward movement on the SAFE Act being implemented with regards to the ammunition registration piece. And so if you follow the train of logic around why would a gubernatorial candidate like Gavin Newsom put forward a proposal that has not proven successful elsewhere?
Mm-hmm.
The only conclusion I've come to is that it's to score cheap political points. He's running for governor in California in 2018. This is a very anti-gun, ideologically driven initiative that, you know, I think he's just looking to score what he thinks are easy political points and, you know, get his name out in the media. And again, what's really shameful for me is that these won't impact public safety. We won't be any safer, you know, with these laws. So, why should we give up our civil rights and our civil liberties for something that won't provide a return to society?
Absolutely. Well, you know, look, we talk about this all the time, Chris. When these anti-gun proposals, you know, when they're aimed at the law-abiding legal gun owners. Right, of which California, by the way, still has quite a few law-abiding legal gun owners. You're not, if that's where you're aiming your focus, you can't expect that the violent criminals are going to be the ones most impacted by these new laws, right? If instead you're actually aiming your focus at people who you know are acquiring their firearms illegally, carrying them illegally, using them in the commission of a violent crime, A, that's a heck of a lot smaller number of individuals to deal with than every law-abiding legal gun owner. And two, you're actually dealing with the people who are creating the public safety problem in the state.
Exactly. Obviously you make complete sense. And it's there's this clear disconnect between, you know, the logic around how do we tackle public safety. I think it's just super frustrating for us to, you know, kind of be revisiting ideas that, you know, haven't proven successful. And, you know, I know I, for one, want to see the, you know, the amount of crime in our country, especially related to firearms, you know, crime be reduced. And let's talk about targeted solutions that go are targeted towards, you know, violent felons, towards the mentally ill. We have the NICS national database that supposedly is supposed to have all that information, but it doesn't, right? So that's a core problem where our system, our background check system, is broken.
Mm-hmm.
If the database does not have all of the registered felons and all the mentally adjudicated individuals in our country. In that way, if we were to focus our effort on fixing NICS, we would have a very strategic, tactical approach versus throwing this huge net and you know, sweeping law-abiding citizens such as myself and the millions of other law-abiding gun owners in California.
Absolutely. You know, we're talking with Chris Chang from the Coalition for More Civil Liberties, And you look at a state or a city like Santa Ana, California. We were talking about Santa Ana, I think it was late last week. You've got, I think, 50 shootings in the first 55 days in Santa Ana, California. Now, again, this is a state already, Chris, with all kinds of gun control laws. The police chief there, Carlos Rojas, says, quote, "We're seeing more gang activity now. And I think a lot of that has to do with gang members being released into the community and a more of a soft on crime approach." So he's not saying that, you know, it's because more people are exercising their Second Amendment rights that we're seeing this. He's not saying it's because the gun laws are too lax. He's saying we are letting too many violent criminals out of prison early, and we're seeing them return to the streets, and we're seeing them commit more violent crimes.
Yep, and I wish that our politicians would actually listen to, you know, our police chiefs and local community leaders who have their ears to the ground. Anyone, you know, that works, you know, I'm sure there's lots of people who work in kind of gang violence prevention have a very different perspective about, you know, trying to restrict access to weapons. But it's all about, you know, targeting those efforts, right? Restricting access to convicted felons or, you know, people who are involved in gang activity and not sweeping up law-abiding citizens in the effort.
Absolutely. So Chris, how can Californians get involved here in the Coalition for More Civil Liberties?
Great question. So there's a brand new website that's been spun up. So if you Google Coalition for More Civil Liberties, there's a lot of different ways around how you can get involved. Clearly, you know, time and money are two of the big efforts in terms of, you know, taking the time to help volunteer, to phone bank, taking the time to talk to your neighbors, your family, your friends, your coworkers about the Coalition for More Civil Liberties that we're trying to build and to really push back against government overreach to really protect our civil liberties. And then, of course, any money that you're able to, you know, support to donate to support the effort is always, you know, something that's oftentimes very key in winning an initiative. It's who can raise the most money and spend those dollars most effectively to get the word out.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I hope that Gavin Newsom gets asked some of these questions. And, you know, it'd be great to actually see the media do its job and to ask simple questions like, how is this supposed to work, right? But a lot of times, as you say, this is an education campaign, not just for the voters, but in many cases, it's an education campaign for the media as well. Because you've got reporters, people who might be interacting, the ones who are going to get to ask those questions to Gavin Newsom, even if they're inclined to ask tough questions, they're probably not familiar with these issues. Covering politics in California, they're probably not familiar with the intricacies of the New York SAFE Act. But if you can let them know, hey, you know what? New York State tried to do what Gavin Newsom wants to do, and it's been 3 years. They haven't figured out a way to do it. If you give or present that information to reporters, then all of a sudden, perhaps, you know, they get the inclination to go ahead and ask a politician about this.
Yep, exactly. And so a big part of the Coalition for More Civil Liberties is to engage the media. It's to engage our, you know, everyday citizens around the facts and to make sure that we know what the facts are, to ask the provocative questions, to really force the issue and the question around, will this be successful? Is there precedent showing that it's successful? And with Gavin Newsom's ideas, there is no proof that they will be successful, and therefore why, you know, I totally am against Newsom's initiatives and, you know, fully support the Coalition for More Civil Liberties.
Well, listen, Chris, we really appreciate you coming on the program. Sure, I know we'll be talking more about this throughout the election year, but appreciate all that you do out there in California, and hopefully we'll get a chance to catch up again very soon.
Thanks, as always, and I hope the next time I come on the program that I have, you know, some good news that we're, you know, succeeding at, you know, defeating this initiative. So I look forward to coming back on in the near future.
Absolutely. We'll talk again. Chris Cheng joining us here on NRA News, Cam & Company, Top Shot champion, and now with the Coalition for More Civil Liberties. You know, going back to Santa Ana, California for a minute, the Orange County Register quoted the police chief there in Santa Ana, Carlos Rojas, said last Friday that the department's 13-member gang unit has, quote, sufficient manpower to go up against the 100 documented gangs in the city and the estimated 4,500 gang members in the city of Santa Ana. Now, Santa Ana has a little over 300,000 people. They have on their police force in total 305 officers. Orange County Register says the continuing fallout of a major budget crisis in the 2009-2010 fiscal year, the chief has openings for 67 more officers. He said, we're making a concerted effort to hire as many officers as we can. And dealing with the the short staffing of officers, at the same time, violent crime is on the increase. Santa Ana was actually named one of the safest small cities in the country back in 2011. Since then, its violent crime has skyrocketed. From 2014 to 2015, violent crime in Santa Ana rose 29%. Orange County Register says that was fueled largely by a 39% jump in aggravated assaults. Compared with January of 2015, the number of shootings this January went up from 24 to 41. By mid-January, the Register says, with the number of shootings reaching more than 20, the department began orchestrating sweeping probation compliance checks, seizing guns, rifling through furniture, kitchen cabinets, bedrooms and cars, looking for drugs, paraphernalia, or signs of recent gang activity at the homes of people on probation. Police Union President John Franks said on Friday that Prop 47, that was the referendum passed by California voters that reclassified some nonviolent felonies, including those for drug and theft crimes, to misdemeanors, which can lead to earlier releases from jail, even if the offender has a violent criminal history. You can have 18 violent charges in your history, 18 convictions for violent crimes, but if you're currently behind bars for a nonviolent crime, you can get out early. Again, passed by the voters in California. And since then, you have seen a number of jurisdictions see an increase in violent crime. Now, why did voters pass this? Well, Supreme Court said that California's prisons were overcrowded. State didn't have the money to build more prisons, or at least didn't have the money to allocate to build more prisons, didn't want to move money from somewhere else to build more prisons. And so this was their plan. We're going to let some people out early. We're going to move a number of inmates from the state prison to the county jail, where they will serve their sentence instead of being in the state pen. This, of course, means that there are fewer spaces in the county jail for individuals who might be a flight risk, might be a risk to society. Previous years, you might have seen these individuals held without bond or held with a high bond. Now there's no room to hold them before their trial. So they're arrested, they're caught. Even if the prosecutors would want to keep them behind bars, it's not always they're not always able to do so. So instead, they're back out on the streets awaiting their trial, which can lead to problems of its own. So Police Union President John Frank said that Prop 47 has created a, quote, perfect storm. He said newly released rival gang members walk into each other. No challenge goes unanswered. The answer, he says, is always going to be violence. He says it doesn't help that the police department is understaffed, no longer has a SWAT team that once helped gang officers deal with the most violent criminals in the city. Their SWAT team disbanded 3 years ago. He said some specialized enforcement is needed. We have a very, very effective gang unit. But again, when you have other enforcement teams, everything helps right now. And again, the president of the police union there in Santa Ana isn't saying, you know what we need? More gun control laws. If we only had more gun control laws, if we only had a ban on magazines over 10 rounds, if we only ensured that every legal gun owner in the state of California had to pay a background check fee every time they bought a box of ammunition, we wouldn't be seeing these crimes. No. The law enforcement officers are saying we don't have the resources to focus on these violent criminals. There are more violent criminals because we don't have the resources to keep them behind bars. And when these violent criminals get out early, a portion of them will commit another crime. The recidivism rate, runs about 33% for individuals in the 5 years after they're released from prison. about one in three going to go on to be convicted of another crime. Orange County Register, again, quoting the chief, he said, I think what you're seeing is the gang members being a lot more brazen. But he said residents should feel safe. He said there's people every day that live comfortably here in Santa Ana. We don't want to send a message that everybody should be in a panic and there should be this kind of fear. Should everybody be concerned? And everybody be willing to call the police when they see something? Absolutely. But don't panic. Don't everybody freak out. Most of you are going to be fine. Most of you are not going to be victims of crime. Some of you will be. Orange County Register quotes Marta Rivera. Said the shootings in her neighborhood have been alarmingly frequent. She lives in an apartment building near the scene of a shooting in an alley. She says bad things happen all around this area. It's not that the criminals live here, but they come here because of the alley. It's very dark there. That's why people gather there to do bad things or to run into the alley to hide. They run through our apartments here and into the alley, and nobody ever sees them. She said she doesn't see many police officers patrolling the area. Telling the Orange County Register, quote, there's a certain point in the day where we go in our homes and we don't really come out anymore. There's a certain point in the day where we go in our homes. We lock the doors. We draw the shades. We don't go out. I've said this before. I'll say it again. In every community in this country, even in the most violent neighborhoods, the number of good people, law-abiding people, people who aren't committing violent crimes, far outnumber those who are a plague on their community. There are far more good people than bad. And even the most violent communities, there are far more people who are trying to raise their kids than who are trying to destroy their community with violence, with drugs. No matter how bad the neighborhood, again, there are more good people than bad living there. But this is what happens to good people in those bad neighborhoods, particularly when they can't protect themselves. When a community, when not just an individual can't protect itself, himself or herself, but when a community has been told, listen, leave it up to law enforcement. Lock your doors. Don't leave the house after a certain time of day. That's how you stay safe. And the law enforcement says, we got to go after these criminals. And anti-gun politicians like Gavin Newsom says, we got to make sure that those good people can't protect themselves. All right, when we come back here on NRA News, Cam and Company, Julie Gunlock will join us from the Independent Women's Forum with a nanny state update. Stick around. We have much more NRA News, Cam and Company coming up right after this. Here at the Great American Outdoor Show at the Pennsylvania Farm Show Complex in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And Teresa Vail is with us. How are you, Teresa?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I am excellent. Love the shirt, by the way.
Thank you. I feel like I'm all NRA'd out with the coat and the shirt.
Right.
Got to represent.
Are you having a good time here at the Great American
Outdoor
Show?
This is actually my first year here. You know, I'm used to SHOT Show and the NRA convention. This is a new ball game. There are tons of people here. I didn't expect that.
Yeah, and this is huge, too.
Yeah,
it's massive.
The complex is amazing.
And it's really interesting because, you know, you mentioned SHOT Show and the NRA annual meeting, and these are both, you know, events that you'll get anywhere from 50 to 80,000 mm-hmm. attendees. Mm-hmm. We're looking at somewhere around 200,000
people. That's what they said.
Here.
I know. Walking through the halls of this place is nuts. It is chaos.
And for 9 days, you know, we get these crowds, which really shows you, I think, just how popular the outdoor sports and the world of the outdoors really, truly is in this country.
I was going to touch on that. That's what I love about these conventions, about these trade shows. This one especially, because it brings together like-minded individuals. You know, everybody here, you know that they're supporters of the NRA, probably, or they love hunting, they love the outdoors. It's like-minded. You're with people who think and feel that the way you do.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit, for those who haven't had a chance to really get to know you,
mm-hmm.
What's your background? How did you get into the world of hunting and shooting?
My dad started me hunting when I was 10. Bow hunting is what I really prefer to do. I didn't get into that until about three, four years ago.
And all of a sudden you you love it.
I'm drawn to it because of the intimacy. You know, instead of being 150 yards or 200 yards away from an animal, you need to be, 30, 40 yards, perhaps even closer. So I like that up and close personal feel to it. And I think it gives you that much more respect for the animal. But there's still a time and place for guns. I prefer guns for protection, for personal defense. I carry. I love going to the range.
You don't want to use a compound bow for personal defense? That's not your preferred choice?
I don't think I'd be as quick on it. Have you seen the TV show Arrow?
I have.
Okay, so that's what comes to mind.
Right.
He's a badass with a bow, but...
We can't all be superheroes.
But we can't all be superheroes as much as I would like to be, and I try to be.
Right. Yeah. And so tell me, because you've had the opportunity to go and do some incredible hunts and visit some incredible places, the people that you talk to and that you're involved with in these hunts, is that as important to you as the game that you're actually going after?
I think hunting, there are two aspects to it. It can be very, very personal, and then it can be very, very social. The dichotomy, I think, is what makes it so fascinating. I like the social aspect because we can go out pheasant hunting, and while you're pheasant hunting, you get to joke around and talk, and you don't have to be hush-hush. It's very social and lively. But then that other side of it is you can be in the tree stand alone by yourself for hours and just have that solitude and peacefulness, and that's what I prefer. I'm a lone wolf. It's what I prefer. But the dichotomy of it is fascinating, and I do love both aspects.
In this modern connected world, too, I think it's so important to have those moments where you are disconnected. And it's you and the tree stand and nature, and there's that focus,
mm-hmm.
But there's also that ability to just sort of let all of that other stuff
go, right? I couldn't agree more. And that's my peaceful place. So everybody knows the Serenity tattoo that I have. And I got that because of my feelings for the woods. The woods gave that peacefulness to me. When Dad started taking me out when I was 10, there are no cell phones. You can bring a book, sure, but you're still disconnected from the internet, from the age of social media, which I hate. There's a time and place for it, but I do hate it.
Yeah.
And you're away from that, and you get to focus on what's really important.
Absolutely. So tell me about what you have going on now with all of your,
mm-hmm.
Again, it is an interconnected world, and we get a chance to watch you on TV.
Yes.
We get a chance to watch you on NRANews.com.
Yeah.
I can't even keep up with everything you're doing.
We just wrapped up filming season 5 of NRA All Access. I hosted season 5. We're now moving on to season 6 of NRA All Access, and that's on Outdoor Channel Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time.
Okay.
And we're just coming up with new ideas for season 6, moving into season 6. Season 5 was incredible. We went to Italy and hunted pheasants there and toured the Franchi shotgun factory and saw the intense history behind it. So I'm looking forward to season 6 and what it brings.
Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Very pleased to have with us on the program right now our friend Julie Gunlock from the Independent Women's Forum. How you doing, Julie?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Absolutely. It's always good to talk with you. And you're writing about the because everything's political now, so you're delving into just layers of controversy by writing about Girl Scout cookies. You realize this, right?
I do know this, and I did defend the Girl Scouts, and I know that leaves me vulnerable to some people who are big critics of the Girl Scouts. But in this case, I did defend them.
And I love the fact you start out by talking about who doesn't long for the days where you could just eat a damned cookie without agonizing about its origin, its ingredient list, the condition of the workers who made it, the plants and animals who gave their lives for it, or the people who are selling it to you, right?
Right.
One of your friends said, I just want to chew without so much guilt, but you will be made to care.
Eating has become, really difficult territory. It is riddled with landmines. They can go off. You can make someone mad by, or especially in the mom world, you know, if you don't have the appropriate snacks, or, you know, just showing up, for instance, to a school function and with the wrong snack. One of my children graduated from preschool last year, and yes, it was a graduation, which is ridiculous. And they had a little party afterwards, and one of the moms showed up with one of those gigantic buckets of cheese balls. And I watched her walk around the room and apologize to all of the moms because she didn't have time to go and get something sort of healthy and crunchy. And let me tell you, those kids, they skipped right over my Pinterest, you know, hummus board and went straight for those. They didn't eat anything. All they wanted was those cheese balls. So she was very popular among the kids, if not with the parents.
I know of the gigantic bucket of cheese balls of which you speak. They have found a place in our home as well. on many occasion, but you know, yes. but here's the thing. So you know, you're writing about the fact that now you've got people who are saying Girl Scouts shouldn't sell cookies because they make people fat, right? Because they're cookies, they should be selling celery sticks or tofu squares or something, but not cookies
or carbon credits. I mean, ridiculous. Yeah, so apparently these health nuts are getting all, you know, they're wringing their hands and clutching their pearls because the Girl Scouts have the nerve to sell something that contains sugar. And so there is some criticism. And my piece is like, look, people, you know, this is a fundraiser for the Girl Scouts, okay? Mm-hmm. So I know that you think kale salads sell well, but they don't, okay? Cookies are have become this sort of iconic thing once a year. Everyone looks forward to it. Look, you know, I don't think anyone thinks these cookies are, you know, the best thing in the world, but it's just a way to support a club that a lot of people support. And so, it's fun. It's fun to do. And also there's some lessons about, you know, it teaches girls how to, you know, approach people and do a sales pitch. And it gives them confidence to sort of sell something and earn a badge for it. But then I talked about the nutrition. You can eat like 5 Do-Si-Dos for 160 calories. And there were a couple others that were really reasonable. 2, 3, 4 cookies. One of them was 5 cookies for under 150 calories. That is not a lot. And so what I also talked about is that in nutrition circles now, it's no longer moderation, it is perfection. So you're not supposed, it used to be where people were told, you know, eat healthy, but, you know, every once in a while, treat yourself. That is no longer the rule. The rule now is eat clean all the time. You know, you need to get rid of all of these things from your diet. You know, and you have Hollywood actresses who do this, these kind of cleanses, and they say that they're dairy-free and sugar-free and caffeine-free, and they go through this list of things that they don't eat. And that's becoming, you know, sort of the norm. And I think that's very unhealthy, particularly for girls. I cite some statistics on eating disorders and this new condition called orthorexia, this sort of, you know, not you having to be perfect all the time. And so I think the critics are doing great damage. I think it's terrible. And I think Girl Scout cookies are a good lesson to girls about eating, you know, small quantity, you know, so having a treat every once in a while. And, you know, they come out once a year. It's the ultimate lesson that these things are not to be, you know, consumed on a constant basis.
Absolutely. But you know, you also have people who freeze them so they can eat them all year round, right? Pull them out of the freezer when they need a thin mint. I will say that we don't have any Girl Scout cookies in the house at the moment, but we do have approximately 50 bars of the world's finest chocolate, Julie, if you would like, at only a dollar. I'm sure this is something else that the food police can criticize, right? Because it's not just the Girl Scouts, right? We've got our school fundraiser going on right now.
Yeah, they can't stand the, I mean, you know, and I write in the piece, look, people, it's a fundraiser. Cookies sell. Sweet things sell, okay? That's why they're used. I mean, celery does not sell. It's another one of these things where people just get all upset about, there's no reason for it, and they take the fun out of things. They make people feel guilty, and now people are wondering, oh, maybe I shouldn't do that, maybe it's bad, you know, it's just, again, it's taking the fun out of things.
Well, I'm glad that you're here to bring back the fun, to bring in the noise, bring in the fun. Julie Gunlock from the Independent Women's Forum. Now, we've only got a couple of minutes left here, but I also... you're on a tear, Julie, about the CDC, right?
Yeah, I've been 3 pieces on it. Yeah. I'm really tired of that.
They're going to declare you a public health menace. You know that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just very quickly, CDC comes out with these new guidelines telling women if they ever have a drink, they've got to be on birth control because we're all a bunch of, you know, trampy booze hounds who, you know, can't control ourselves. And so it was insulting. The feminists got all upset about it. And, hey, I applaud the feminists for getting upset about it. But this is the thing that bothers me about the feminists. For years, they have demanded more government intervention in their lives. They want big government programs. They want big government health care. And then they get something like the CDC coming out and pushing them around. Why are they surprised? They demanded this. So I find this that kind of this outrage by the feminists to be a little bit hilarious to watch.
Do you see it going away anytime soon? Do you see it?
No, of course not. Feminists are totally mainstream feminists are totally confused. They don't get the connection between when you demand more government, you're going to get nosy bureaucrats telling you how to live your life. They don't get that. I mean, if you don't want the government in your business, then you shouldn't be asking for the ACA and Obamacare and all sorts of stuff. You shouldn't be asking for this stuff. You should be wanting more freedom to make your own choices in healthcare. And when you give that up, like promoting the ACA and all sorts of other big government programs, then you're going to get these CDC guidelines, which are insulting and are sexist. That's the trade-off. And when feminists realize that real freedom comes with slimmer government, with smaller government, with more flexible government, that's when we'll have true feminism in this country.
Julie Gunlock with the Independent Women's Forum. Thank you, as always, for coming on the program. It was fantastic talk with you, and hopefully we'll get a chance to see you next week. Are you going to be up there at CPAC?
No, I'm going to be in California. I'm sorry, I'm going to miss you guys.
Duck and CPAC, All right. It's going to get you in some trouble there. But
I know.
All right, well, enjoy California.
Yeah, I'm not
about as far away from CPAC as you can get.
I'm not complaining. I might not come back. Just kidding.
All right, Julie. Well, listen, you're going right into the heart of the nanny state while you're there.
Yeah, no kidding.
Be careful and don't have any fun.
Right.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Unfortunately, that is almost all of the time that we have for you on today's program. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll be talking with Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart about some of the latest Second Amendment news around the country. Also, a judge this afternoon ruling that, yes, Hillary Clinton's aides and U.S. State Department officials should be questioned under oath about whether or not Hillary Clinton's private email system was an effort to skirt open records law. How about that? All right, we'll have more on that story on tomorrow's NRA News, Cam & Company as well. Thanks for being a part of today's program. We'll see you here soon on NRA News, Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler.